This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election coverage from KALW Public Media. I'm Ben Trefney, news director at KALW. I'm joined by Sonia Narang, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, Ben.
We're listening to NPR's national election coverage and matching it with KALW's regional elections coverage. And Sonia and I are joined by a special guest. Sonia, like to give an introduction?
Yes. With us here, we have Alexis Terrazas. He's the editor-in-chief of El Tecolote newspaper, which is a bilingual media outlet based in San Francisco. It's good to have you here, Alexis.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So your newspaper published a bilingual voter guide in English and Spanish. And why was it so important to you and your team to address issues from a Latinx perspective?
Yeah, great question. It's something we've been doing for years, and it actually kind of falls in line with the mission of our media organization, which is to provide credible, accurate information in languages to our community that they understand, right? And with this election, I'm sure we've seen massive amounts of money being put into different propositions to support and defeat. So for us, with all of the massive rapid misinformation and deceitful ads, it was really important for us to really break down these propositions in the language that our community understands.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the communities is East Palo Alto that you cover, mm-hmm. and housing insecurity is a huge deal over there. So California Prop 21 would enact rent control. How is it going to affect people there?
Absolutely. And when we were on the ground, Daniel Marquez and I, one of the key things that folks kept talking about were rents. And even though there is a rent moratorium there, that they're expected to pay all that back. Right. So us in San Francisco, we know what rent control looks like, but that's not something that obviously exists in other parts of the state. So in particular, this is a proposition that we're really paying close attention to, because it could have ramifications on the peninsula. As we know, housing insecurity is not just a San Francisco issue, it's a California issue, and more importantly, it's a peninsula, specifically a peninsula issue as well.
And we're seeing, Alexis, that California is obviously got a supermajority of Democrats in the state legislature. It's a very, very blue state, and we haven't seen returns coming in quite yet. But what do you think the reaction is in the communities that you've been serving to what's happening nationally with the presidential and the state Senate or the U.S. Senate races?
Yeah, so I mean, what we've been seeing for the last 4 years is just a lot of mobilization, within our communities, and a lot of local action too. I think what we've been seeing is just this reaction to this national election, just really kind of grassroots movements being taken place locally, and that includes certain candidates running, right? We had on our own podcast that's going to air probably Friday, candidate Jackie Fielder, who is a renter,
right.
And I think what she was saying is in the state legislature, I think there's only one renter there. So that's what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Alexis. Alexis Terrazas is the editor-in-chief of El Tecolote, serving many communities here in San Francisco. You're listening to KALW's special election coverage, The Bay Votes 2020, and we're going back to NPR right now. Thank you.
Support for NPR's elections coverage comes from Drexel University. Drexel's academic model is designed to prepare visionary leaders to address the challenges of a changing world. More at drexel.edu/ambitioncantwait.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2020 election. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Polls are now closed in every state but Hawaii and Alaska. The most competitive races of the night, though, remain too early to call.
Former Vice President Joe Biden currently leads President Donald Trump in the Electoral College 209 to 112, according to the AP. But swing states like Florida, Pennsylvania, and Arizona remain up in the air.
On the Senate side, Democrats have flipped one seat in Colorado, and former Governor John Hickenlooper has defeated incumbent Republican Cory Gardner there.
We've had enough of leaders in Washington thinking it was their job to only represent blue America or red America, red Colorado or blue Colorado. I've always believed it's my job to represent all Colorado.
Republicans, however, also flipped a seat in Alabama, where former football coach Tommy Tuberville has beat incumbent Democrat Doug Jones.
Alabama, welcome back to the Republican U.S. Senate.
All of that means at this point there has been no net change in the balance of the U.S. Senate. And to talk about that, we're joined by NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Ari.
Let's take a broad look at the Senate map tonight. Republicans have held few key seats that Democrats are still hoping to win back. In some cases, that has escaped their grasp tonight. What's the landscape as you see it now?
Well, I think it looks like the path to the Democrats flipping control of the Senate is getting narrower and narrower as the night goes on. Republicans holding on to seats in Texas and Kansas, and Lindsey Graham winning a re-election in South Carolina. These were always sort of reach Democratic seats, but we were looking to them as signs of, you know, maybe this would be a big blue wave night. I think we're seeing enough results coming in that we do not believe this is going to be a big blue wave night, certainly not down the ballot. So the path for Democrats to win a majority is just getting more difficult. We're still looking and waiting for results in Arizona, where Democrats expect to flip a seat there, and in Maine, where incumbent Senator Susan Collins has had probably her toughest re-election yet. But again, even with those two seats, that might not be enough to get Democrats where they need to be. I'd also note we've been watching North Carolina really closely all night, largely seen as a bellwether state for how the Senate would go. Republican incumbent Tom Tillis is leading there. The Associated Press has not called the race, but Republicans I'm talking to tonight feel pretty good at their chances of holding on to a Senate majority, albeit with fewer seats.
And explain why that matters, what the difference is between if we imagine that Biden wins the presidency, which we certainly don't know, but what is the difference between a Democratic president with a democratically controlled Congress and a Democratic president with a Republican controlled Congress?
Well, I think what's interesting is if Republicans do retain control of the Senate, in some ways it'll be a status quo on Capitol Hill. We're looking at still split control of Congress. Democrats are still heavily favored to hold their majority in the House. There's no reason to doubt that will happen. So whoever the next president is, whether it be Donald Trump or Joe Biden, they're likely to be facing a divided Congress. And what has the lesson been of the past decade of divided government is that it's a recipe for gridlock and for confrontation. And if that is the outcome of this election, I think the idea that we're going to see big sweeping legislative change becomes less and less likely.
And on the House side, I interviewed Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday, and she was optimistic about Democrats picking up seats tonight. So far, Republicans have won a couple of seats.
They have, and I think that's one of the things I'm looking at that suggests that this sort of down ballot activity we're seeing is evidence that we're not going to see a big dramatic Democratic wave tonight. Democrats still forecast to pick up seats in the single digits, but you know, forecasters were going into the night saying they could pick up as many as 15 to 20. That seems really unlikely, and we are seeing Democrats losing in some places. Two Democratic incumbents have already lost in Florida and South Florida, where the party took a bit of a whooping tonight. There's Democrats in New York, Max Rose, who is a freshman Democrat who won in the 2018 Democratic wave in a Staten Island district, a district very friendly to Donald Trump. He's down in the polls right now, but that race hasn't been officially called yet either. Bellwether races in Virginia, you know, Republican incumbents have been winning there in Arkansas. So it is definitely not the terrible night that a lot of House Republicans were braced for. And if anything, I think I hear much more optimism coming from Republican strategists than Democrats at this hour.
One race that is getting national attention, not because it was competitive, but because of the person who won it, Marjorie Taylor Greene, somebody who has made racist statements, supported the conspiracy theory QAnon, and is now headed to Congress.
She is, and I would also note that in one of the Georgia Senate races tonight, Kelly Loeffler, I can't say she won the runoff because it hasn't been declared, but her conservative opponent, Doug Collins, conceded the race to her, which means she will be the Republican likely going to a runoff in January. And she courted Marjorie Greene's endorsement in the Senate race, and I think that speaks to sort of the influence, the rising influence that someone like Marjorie Greene and her views have inside the Republican Party.
So the Associated Press has actually just called the Georgia Senate going
they
to the
did.
Runoff. So
okay,
yes, it caught up with you as you were speaking.
Yeah, but I mean, it speaks to a lot that a Senate candidate would ever court a House candidate's endorsement in any race, but it certainly speaks to her influence in that state that Kelly Loeffler felt the need to not only court her, but campaign with her. She cut an ad with her. I do think, you know, President Trump has endorsed Marjorie Greene. She's been sort of embraced by the party. And yeah, there is a fringe element here that has been elevated in the Trump era. And part of that fringe element is coming to Congress in January.
NPR Susan Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to go back to NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond now, because she's been keeping tabs on how Election Day has unfolded on social media. A lot of the strains that we've been talking about here this evening, the kind of adherence to conspiracy theories, worries about violence, polarization on the one hand, a lot of this has played out on social media. So I want to ask Shannon how all this is playing out tonight. So how has the day gone, Shannon?
Well, you know, I think, you know, back in 2016, the lesson that I think a lot of the social media companies took away was they need to be much more aware of things like foreign interference. And we've seen them crack down much more on that, you know, not allowing Russia to use their platforms to influence or manipulate voters. But the story of this election has really been about misinformation being spread by Americans. You know, we've seen throughout the course of this campaign, false claims about voting, you know, many being pushed by President Trump and his allies. We saw more of those claims today.
I did want to ask you, though, just briefly, if you just stay on that subject, is there any sign of foreign interference? This has been such a big subject over the last 4 years, like how this started, who got caught flat-footed, and, you know, why didn't we know more? Did the Obama administration do more to sort of stop this? Is there any sign of that today? I heard what you just said, that most of what we're seeing is American-made.
Yeah, well, I'd say what the researchers say is that, you know, we have seen some efforts, certainly by Russia. Russia's, according to all the experts, the national security experts as well, Russia is interested in interfering, you know, and does have a preference and, you know, has made some, you know, moves. However, you know, a lot of the platforms, the agencies have just gotten better at identifying this, so it's less effective. And the other concern is that, you know, in this moment of election day, you know, we may not see as much foreign interference, but if, as seems incredibly likely, we're not going to have a clear answer on a winner and there may be sort of some period of confusion, that is something that foreign actors could really seize on to spread more information, you know, to amplify concerns and to really undercut the, you know, confidence in the results.
And polls are closing across the country. So what's next?
Right. So we are moving into this very vulnerable period, is what all of the misinformation experts I speak to say. You know, and this will be a really big test for these social media companies. Now, both Facebook and Twitter have said they're going to put warning labels on posts that try to claim premature victory before a race is called. They are going to be putting notices on their apps telling people votes are still being counted. They're relying on reputable media outlets to decide when a race is called. We've already seen Twitter put one of these labels on a tweet from the Trump campaign tonight about results in South Carolina. But this really is going to be the test of their systems. How quickly can they do that? Because what we've seen before when they sort of label these things, sometimes it takes quite a while to do. And these messages, these posts, they can spread really widely in the meantime, you know, sort of unchecked.
And before I let you go, Shannon, do you this may be hard for you to sort of describe, but I just want to try. Do you think that most Americans now accept that there is this possibility of these platforms being used for misinformation, whether innocently or maliciously, and disinformation? Do you think that that's an idea that has taken hold so that Americans are perhaps approaching this more skeptically? Because that's certainly something that a lot of news organizations would like, a lot of sort of news literacy groups would like. People have been working on this. But do you think that that idea has taken hold or not? Just based on your reporting.
That certainly is the hope. And I think there is more awareness, certainly when it comes to things like foreign interference. And there actually has been some evidence that shows if you tell people, you know, something is being, you know, comes from, you know, a Russian-backed account, people may be more skeptical. I think it gets much messier when it is American accounts and particularly political figures like the president who are spreading misleading claims. You know, for people to have more ability to be skeptical of those things and to judge them with a bit of a keen eye.
That is NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond. Shannon, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Ari?
I want to bring in NPR's Mara Liasson and Juana Summers for some analysis. First, let's do an update on the electoral vote count. So far, we actually made a misstatement at the beginning of the segment. We said Trump had 112. He actually has 118 votes. Biden has 209. And there are 211 yet to be called, which includes basically all of the big swing states that we were waiting on, we are still waiting on. Mara Liasson, and this is something that we had been told to expect. What does this mean going forward? Are we likely to get a result tomorrow, the end of the week? I mean, what's your forecast?
I think some states will report tomorrow. For instance, there are a lot of big metropolitan areas in states that Biden had big leads in the polls that haven't reported. Philadelphia, Detroit, Milwaukee, we're going to hear about those. And what we're waiting for, I would say, is the big four: Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And if Donald Trump can pick off two of those, he can win. I think if Joe Biden hangs on to all of them, he could even afford to lose one, and he'd still win. assuming he gets one of those Nebraska congressional districts. So it's a very close race. We don't have the results. And this is what we've been describing for weeks, that there would be perhaps a lead. The president might have a lead in popular votes on election night. We don't know if that's the case. That's something called a red mirage. And then over time, maybe it shifts to Biden. But the point is, we have some of the biggest, swingiest states out there still to be called, and we're not going to know tonight.
And we've said it before, but it's worth saying again, not having a result on election night does not mean anything is going wrong. And particularly, as Shannon Bond was just saying, it's a time ripe for misinformation and hoaxes. People should hold steady and be patient.
Right. And we haven't heard yet from either of the candidates.
Let's turn to NPR's Juana Summers, who is following who is voting and what they're voting based on. And Juana, I know you've been looking at these numbers all night. What jumps out at you?
I have. So two things. I've been spending a lot of time looking at young voters. And to kind of set the stage here, we should point out that the youngest generation of voters, the youngest demographic group, is a really diverse group. It's browner than the overall population. And they are voting in pretty large numbers for Joe Biden. And when you break that down, taking a look at race, they're Black, Asian, and Latino voters under the age of 30 support former Vice President Biden by overwhelming margins. But if you drill down those numbers, take a look at what young white voters are doing. They prefer Joe Biden by about 11 points. So a much tighter race there for those votes. It seems like they are voting in fairly large numbers. Ahead of Election Day, we saw as many as 8 million or more votes from young voters cast early.
I want to jump in and note that according to the Associated Press, Republicans have won re-election in Louisiana and Mississippi Senate races, both of which they were favored to win, deep red states there. Mara, it's unusual for a president not to win re-election. What do you attribute President Trump's risk of not winning to over these last 4 years? I mean, what did he do wrong?
Events. I mean, he has a pandemic. He has a recession. And the president got 46.1% of the vote in 2016. 46% is usually what Republicans get when they lose a presidential election. It's pretty much what John McCain got in 2008. And he's the first president who has never broken 50%. So in terms of what did he do wrong, he never was getting the benefit of a good economy when the economy was good. And he never seemed to be hurt that much by a bad economy when the economy went sour after the pandemic. He had a high floor and a low ceiling. He just always has seemed to be stuck in that mid-40s approval rating. And what we know from history, and historical rules only work till they stop working, but a president's approval rating for re-election, when he stands for re-election, is usually his ballot. And that's the big question tonight, you know, or in the days ahead, will Donald Trump do better than his approval rating?
That is NPR Mara Liasson and NPR's Juana Summers. We are going to take a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to live special coverage of the 2020 election from NPR News.
This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election coverage from KALW Public Media. I'm Ben Trefney, news director here at the station. I'm joined by Sonia Narang, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Hi, Sonia.
Hello, Ben.
And we are joining NPR's national election coverage and bringing you some regional election coverage. And we have some results that have come in. We have 11% now of the state reporting, Sonia. And one thing that I know a lot of people have been paying attention to is Prop 22. Do you have the election results in front of you, Sonia?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. So 22 is the prop that looks at giving further benefits to app-based drivers. And right now, it's looking like the small percentage of precincts that we're seeing reported is saying yes at around 56.5%. And I'm just refreshing it. It changes a little bit, but it looks like it is coming in a little bit in favor of the yes vote.
But like we said, it's about 11% of precincts reporting. So this is very much like the national race right now. We might be seeing early returns, but we have to be patient as we wait to see all the results coming in. And meanwhile, we're going to be joined by Joshua Sorodiak. He was in the Audio Academy class of 2020 here at KALW. And you have some information on another one of these state propositions, Josh.
Yeah, I was looking at Prop 19. That is the state ballot measure one of the state ballot measures that deals with property taxes. What Prop 19 would do is it would allow homeowners to take their property tax assessment with them when they move to a new residence. Mm-hmm. It would also change the inheritability of property taxes so that children and grandchildren who inherit a property would no longer receive the same property tax assessment as the people that they're inheriting from.
Yeah, it's interesting because for the last 40 years or so, issues around property taxes have been kind of a third rail in California politics. But we have a couple different measures like this one that have been coming up in the 2020 election here in California. So how's it looking so far with 11% of the precincts reporting, Josh?
Yeah, so I'm looking at election results from the state of California. I'm seeing about 14.4% of results coming in so far.
They're counting fast.
And with that number, Prop 19 is looking like it's passing with 53% of the vote currently.
All right. Thank you very much. And have you heard any buzz about Prop 19 at all from any of the people who are involved with it or fans or opponents of it?
I wouldn't say buzz so much. I would say that the yes on Prop 13 folks are a lot more numerous than the no on Prop 13. They also had a lot more funding behind them. Prop 13 had about $45 million go into the yes campaign and only $45,000 go into the no campaign.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Right. And that's Prop 19, right?
Money in politics.
Yeah. It's a big deal to look at where the funding is coming from. We also have Vivian Basu Skinner, one of our Audio Academy Fellow alums from 2020. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So, Vivian, you spent time looking into Prop 21. That's another big measure because it's looking at rent control, and it would essentially expand rent control across the state of California. Can you tell me what results are coming in right now?
Yeah, so right now it's just above passing, so it's at about 50, a little over 50 to 49% passing, but again, that's only about 11.4% of the results that are in so far.
Yeah, so it's just a small number. If it does pass, what would happen?
Yeah, so essentially it would, like you said, expand rent control. And the way that it would do that is it would repeal the current Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which prohibits rent control on housing that's been built since 1995. So if Prop 21 is passed, it would repeal that Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act and in turn allow local jurisdictions to make their own laws to pass rent control.
Right. And affordable housing is a huge issue here in California. Are you hearing buzz from either side?
Yeah, there's not that much. The Twitter and Instagram accounts have been kind of silent today, but it sounds like there's a lot of editorial pieces that are going on from people writing in traditional media.
Right. Well, we'll get back to this issue later in the night as we get more results.
Thank you so much, Vivian Basu Skinner and Joshua Sorodiak and Sonia Narang. We will be going back to NPR's coverage of the national races, which are obviously taking a lot of the attention from around the country. But we'll be back with more in about 15 minutes here at KALW with our elections coverage as well. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for NPR's elections coverage comes from Drexel University. Drexel's academic model is designed to prepare visionary leaders to address the challenges of a changing world. More at drexel.edu/ambitioncantwait.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2020 election. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We are still waiting for results from some of the most watched states this election night. Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin are all still too early to call. And we should note, we may not get results from those states tonight.
This has been an election like no other, with more than 100 million Americans voting early during a pandemic. At the moment, the electoral vote count, according to the Associated Press, stands at 209 for Joe Biden and 118 for President Trump. But again, several key states are too early to call still.
On the Senate side, several high-profile Republicans have won re-election that, again, according to the Associated Press, including Mitch McConnell in Kentucky and Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. And Republicans have also picked up a seat in Alabama, where Tommy Tuberville defeated incumbent Democrat Doug Jones.
I want to thank President Donald Trump. He is, without a doubt, in my lifetime, the guy that's done more for the United States of America than any president I've ever been around.
Democrats picked up a seat in Colorado where former Governor John Hickenlooper defeated incumbent Senator Cory Gardner. But they also lost a high-profile race in South Carolina, as we just heard. Here is challenger Jamie Harrison speaking after losing in his race against incumbent Senator Lindsey Graham.
You know, Senator Graham and I may have our differences, but I hope he will maintain the spirit of cooperation he's known for while we take a step forward in creating a new South that is so possible.
One of the key states in this race has been Arizona, and polls are closed there. The early counting has Joe Biden ahead. It is a state that Trump carried in 2016. And NPR's Kirk Ziegler is there in downtown Phoenix. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Ari. How are you?
All right. Bring us up to speed on the state of play there in Arizona.
Well, as things seem to be shaking out, Arizona was a state that Joe Biden wanted to win, and now the way things appear to be going, it may be a state that he absolutely needs to win. So far, looking at the early unofficial results, Biden is doing well, very well, in Maricopa County, here in Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix. It's the most populated county in Arizona. And it's a county that has shifted purple, if not blue. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But it was a rockbed conservative county. Democrats have been making a lot of inroads here, and they needed a big turnout, and it's looking like they're getting it.
It's a huge shift. I mean, when you think that Maricopa County was home to Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who
exactly.
built a career on being cruel and ruthless to immigrants. What accounts for the change?
Well, that you mentioned the Joe Arpaio, that was a story that didn't get a whole lot of attention in 2016, of course, because of the obvious, the Trump winning. But Joe Arpaio lost in part due to a large voter turnout among Latinos. Again, in 2018, Democrats won a Senate seat here in part because, or the pundits say, the younger Latinos coming of age. Of course, Latinos are not a big monolith either, but there's also a shift in demographics. There are people moving here, younger people moving here from states like California. Arizona is increasingly, you know, urban, just like most Western states, and that does tend to favor Democrats.
I also want to ask about some of the interesting endorsements that Joe Biden got in Arizona, because Senator Jeff Flake, retired Republican senator from Arizona, and Cindy McCain, the widow of the 2008 Republican presidential candidate, Senator John McCain, both supported Biden.
Yeah, this is a state where the Republican Party has, you know, people talk about the Republican Party fracturing. I mean, I think this is sort of one of the epicenters of that, Arizona, because you sort of a lot of never Trumpers and then just all in with Donald Trump. Martha McSally, the senator who was appointed to that seat from after John McCain passed away, is, I guess, in the fight of her life. She's trailing tonight. She was expected to trail, expected not a favorite against Mark Kelly, the senator, the former astronaut, rather, and the husband of former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Martha McSally had kind of an uncomfortable relationship with Donald Trump, first tying herself to him and then kind of backing away a little bit as the polls shifted. So this is definitely an interesting state for a number of reasons, and I think you can for sure say it's now a battleground state, much like many of the other Western states around it have become.
All right, that's NPR's Kirk Ziegler in Phoenix, Arizona, a state that has not officially been called by the Associated Press, though it looks to be leaning Joe Biden's way tonight. Thanks a lot, Kirk.
You're welcome, Ari.
Now let's go to NPR's Tamara Keith, who is covering the Trump campaign. And Tam, I'm curious what you're hearing from folks in the Trump camp about the way Arizona's going tonight.
Well, so earlier in this hour, I told you that the TVs are tuned to Fox News in the election night party at the White House. Well, Fox News called Arizona for Joe Biden. Now, AP hasn't. We haven't on our air because we follow AP. But Fox News did. This earned a very upset response from someone inside the Trump campaign war room who texted me that Fox is calling it way too early and that the election day votes will fall heavily for the president and it's way too early to call. Though this person earlier in the evening said that although they were generally feeling positive about the president's chances in many of these swing states, that this person said they were nervous about Arizona, and that nervousness is based on Kirk's reporting and what we're seeing, is well-founded.
I also want to bring in NPR's Scott Detrow, who's covering the Biden campaign. And Scott, so much depends on those upper Midwestern states where we may not get a result tonight, perhaps not even tomorrow, the Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. What are you hearing from the Biden campaign about those states?
Yeah, Asma Khalid just did a survey of the very cold drive-in rally where the two of us are shivering out here talking to you. And she said it's a quote that you could have, as Domenico's been saying, you could have pulled from the air a year ago, 2 years ago. They're cautiously optimistic. They're nervous. They think it comes down to Pennsylvania.
And remind us why we don't have results in those states and may not for some time yet.
Sure. This is very important, and it's going to be critically important over the coming days. These are states where Democrats voted overwhelmingly by mail. Now, President Trump has focused on mail-in ballots coming in late in Pennsylvania. That is not the issue right now. What is the issue right now is the fact that Pennsylvania law does not allow counties to begin counting those mail-in ballots until Election Day. So big Democratic counties like Philadelphia that have hundreds of thousands of ballots that will likely overwhelmingly lean Democrat are just now in the process of opening and sorting those ballots. We have heard, according to our colleague Jeff Brady, that Philadelphia will not have another big update until tomorrow morning. It's a pretty similar situation in Wisconsin as well, one of those other very important states, where Milwaukee is not going to expect to report its ballots until 4 or 5 a.m. at the earliest. So at the moment, it looks like President Trump is up big in these three big states, but there's a lot of Democratic votes out there. And this is, of course, the ulcer situation for Democrats who were worried about how President Trump would characterize this. So far, of course, we have not heard anything from President Trump, and he is waiting for the votes to come in like the rest of us.
This is what many have described as the red mirage, that at first it looks like President Trump is way up in these states because Republicans tended to vote the day of, but Democrats who voted earlier might have their votes counted later.
That's right. And again, this is a much closer race than a lot of Democrats wanted. And there's millions of Democrats who are just beside themselves saying, in the middle of a pandemic, how could it be this close? But that's the country we live in. I would say two data points kind of go against the doom scrolling of many Democrats right now. First is the fact that Joe Biden is up by about 200,000 votes in Arizona. This is clearly a trench warfare campaign, kind of a Maraism, I feel like. And if that lead holds, this would be the first shift from the 2016 electoral map, and that's a big deal. That would give Biden a few more ways to navigate this map going forward, and it would take some votes away from President Trump.
Just briefly, if we were to hear from either of the two candidates tonight, technically it would have to happen in the next 10 minutes. We're almost at the stroke of midnight. Do you expect we'll hear from either of them before the sun rises?
I think we will expect to hear something from the Biden camp that kind of gave different messages over the course of the afternoon, but it leaned toward you'll hear something from us. I am one of the pool reporters who will be with former Vice President Joe Biden, so I will know as soon as he's heading over to speak here. So far, we have heard nothing from the Biden campaign on that front.
And the president?
I will give you a giant shruggy. We just don't know.
Can't see a shrug on the radio, Tam.
The last I heard was, you will know when he tweets about it.
All right.
It's worth pointing out he hasn't tweeted yet, though, right?
He hasn't tweeted yet. This is the story of the entire Trump presidency. You will know for sure when he tweets about it. As he says, we'll see what happens.
Watch your Twitter feeds.
Okay, let's go.
And listen to your radio.
All right, let's go to Florida now and Fernand Amandi, who is a Democratic political strategist. He's been following and participating in Florida politics for a long time, and he is with us now. Fernand, speaking of Twitter, I mean, some pretty dire tweets you've been sending out there today. I've been following your feed. So looking at the results in Florida so far, what can you tell us?
Well, Florida did not deliver despite the hopes and expectations of, I think, a lot of folks, not just here in the state, but really around the country. Many of the polls coming into Florida had Biden, while not significantly ahead like you've seen in some of the other key states, certainly with a margin of between plus one, plus two, plus three, plus four. And I think a lot of hopes were dashed early. But more than anything else, the story of what happened in Florida is really two things. Number one, very strong Republican turnout statewide, a lot stronger than I think folks were expecting, because Biden actually had a decent night in some of the key counties. He flipped Duval County, won a couple of the other counties in the central part, the famous I-4 corridor. Where it all came tumbling down, though, is in Miami-Dade County. And Miami-Dade County is a major county for the Democrats because it's the most Democratic county in the state in terms of raw Democratic votes. Hillary Clinton, of course, famously took out about 292,000 votes from Miami-Dade County 4 years ago, winning it by nearly 30 points. Right now, Biden only looks to be winning Dade County by, as best, 9 points. So that is a dramatic underperformance in a county, really, that he could not afford that type of a showing. And that's why Trump is poised to carry Florida's 29 electoral votes, a state that, had it gone for Biden earlier in the night, would have totally changed the direction of how this race is being looked at.
Well, let me just be very clear that we are not calling Florida yet. We are waiting for the Associated Press. I know that some other entities may have called Florida. We are not, and we are going to stick to our knitting on that. But having said that, Fernand, were there any obvious missteps in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think absolutely the one thing that the Trump campaign made clear about Florida, and this goes back to the year 2015. From the moment Donald Trump launched his campaign for the presidency, Florida was always in his sights, and they have been in a permanent campaign mode here in Florida almost unceasingly for the past 5 years, whereas the Democrats, after getting spunked again in 2018 in Florida, it was the one state that was somewhat resistant to the blue wave, did not really begin efforts in earnest until about 2 or 3 months ago. And some folks didn't even think it was really real until Mike Bloomberg got in the race with about 6 weeks to go. So I think it was just a function of not enough time and also having the Republicans successfully brand a lot of the Democrats in the Hispanic community of Florida, and especially for those Cubans, Venezuelans, and Nicaraguan voters who are just anathema to the idea, to the concept of socialism. Republicans branded the Democratic candidates as socialists. The Democrats didn't really respond in kind. And I think that's partially an explanation of why Miami-Dade County, which is, of course, also the most Hispanic county in the state, is part of that Democratic collapse.
I was going to say that two Democratic incumbents have lost their seats, which is interesting. I mean, the fact of the matter is that one of them at least benefited from that blue wave in 2018, and that person is now, Donna Shalala, has now lost her seat. So, and do you attribute that, and when you say that the Republicans have, particularly the Trump administration, has had a relentless focus on Florida, and how do you mean that? You mean sort of politically, or do you mean from a policy standpoint? Were their policies sort of really aimed at keeping Florida in the Republican column, or was it really more of a constant presence? Like, how would you describe their efforts?
Well, the policy efforts were proxy efforts for political engagement, right? I mean, a lot of the issues are beating the drum on the issue of policy towards Venezuela, U.S. policy towards Cuba as well. But to that political focus, Michelle, I mean, Donald Trump literally moved to Florida, made it his home state for a lot of time. Brad Parscale was the campaign manager for the Trump campaign. He was based out of Fort Lauderdale. They launched the reelection effort here in Florida. Yeah. They devoted a significant amount to Latinos for Trump here in Florida as well. So it was clear from early on, Florida was the one state they couldn't afford to lose.
That is Fernand Amandi. He's a Democratic political strategist based in Florida. And you're listening to live special coverage of the 2020 election from NPR News. And we hope you'll stay with us.
This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election coverage from KALW Public Media. We'll be returning to NPR's coverage of the national election in about 5 minutes. But for now, I'm Ben Trefney, news director of KALW. I'm joined by Sonia Narung, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Hello, Sonia.
Hello.
It has been a tense night for sure. And here at the state level and the local level, we are seeing returns coming in. One that I want to note is the kidney dialysis clinic, state requirements that would put some more restrictions and oversight on kidney dialysis clinics, with about 17% of precincts partially reporting so far. That has a 63% no vote, a very strong no vote so far, with only about 17% of precincts reporting so far. But we are going to go and hear about another one of the state propositions. There were a dozen of them from Sarah Lye Sterland, a member of KALW's Audio Academy class of 2020. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hi, Ben. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So can you tell me a little bit about State Measure 18?
Yeah, Prop 18 would amend the California Constitution to allow 17-year-olds to vote in primaries. The legislature approved it this June, but constitutional amendments have to be approved directly by voters.
Mm-hmm. And you worked a lot with teenagers this summer, actually, Sarah.
Yeah, and they were all keen to vote.
But what's the people who actually can vote in California saying so far on this one, Prop 18?
Well, I saw some people note on Twitter that they're puzzled as to why this is so many people are against it. Mm. The initial returns say that just over half of California voters are saying no, 17-year-olds shouldn't be allowed to vote in primaries. And about 46% said voted yes, they should.
Well, we're going to have to be patient as we wait for these results to come in, just like with the rest of the country. Sarah Lee Sterling, thank you so much for that report. And Sonia, we have another guest standing by.
Yes, we have our very own David Boyer at KLW. He's at Manny's in San Francisco. Hello, David.
Hi there.
Hi. What are you seeing right now?
Well, it's really interesting. It's very a mix of tense, and then, you know, Virginia's called and people get excited. What's amazing is there are a lot of local politicians that are coming through here, Raphael Mandelbaum and a few others, but the focus is very much just on the presidential race. It's as if no other race is happening. And there's it's a roller coaster. I think people are living through a little bit of PTSD of of the last election, basically.
Right.
It's a almost 100% Democratic crowd here. And, they are really biting their nails.
Right. Manny's is like the who's who of San Francisco. Have you talked to anyone famous yet tonight?
I haven't talked to anyone famous, but I've talked to a lot of people in the audience and who are watching on a big Jumbotron. And just hearing them go through it the night, you know, their emotions are, people are trying to stay optimistic here. And we shall see what happens. The lieutenant governor was here earlier. And earlier in the day, Gavin Newsom was here, as well as some other statewide politicos.
Yeah, so, Gavin Newsom was.
There's a lot going on here.
Gavin Newsom was phone banking, I think, earlier today, David. I'm wondering, because we are still in the pandemic, of course, what's the social distance scene like there?
So tables are 6 feet apart. Everyone is wearing a mask. Most of the streets. So this is between 15th and 16th on Valencia. Most
in San Francisco.
Of the street is closed. They're in San Francisco, in the Mission, yes. Most of the street is closed, but there is a lot of local folk are hanging out in the bicycle lane and watching it as well. So within the party itself, 6 feet apart, on the other side of the, you know, on the other side of the barrier, less so.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. How do you feel being at a party right now? After being isolated for so long.
It's bizarre, I have to say. I feel like my mask slips a little bit and I worry.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are dealing with that. So there's that double
stress. Thank you, David. We're going to have more from San Francisco later tonight.
Thanks very much, Sonia Narang, and everybody who has been part of the Bay Votes 2020. We're going to go back to NPR. This is KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2020 election. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Elsa Chang. It's all about the path to 270 electoral votes. And at this hour, President Trump has 118, while his Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, has 213. But it could be a while before one of them reaches that magic number of 270.
Vote counting could stretch on in some of the states that could decide the election. A Philadelphia official says it could take days to process hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots in that city. And in Detroit, officials say it could take until tomorrow night to count a backlog of absentee ballots.
Meanwhile, Democrats are expected to hold on to control of the House of Representatives, a fact that Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi celebrated a short time ago.
I'm very, very proud of the fact that tonight, relatively early, we are able to say that we have held the House.
But as November 3rd becomes November 4th, the 2020 election is far from over. Please stay with us.
All right, let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe now. Hey, Ayesha.
Hello.
All right, so we're still seeing all the important battleground states not called yet. What are you hearing from Republicans about their thoughts so far as everyone's just waiting and waiting and possibly looking forward to waiting for days after this?
Well, I mean, Republicans are projecting some confidence. You know, obviously, this night has not gone or has gone in a way that the campaign is happy with so far. Obviously, we're still waiting for calls in swings in key swing states, but they're looking at, you know, the numbers in Florida and Ohio, and they feel like they have been able to do well, even though polls were showing, you know, either a tie or things being closer.
Right. I mean, the fact that we still don't know what the results are in so many of the battleground states. I mean, can you describe how that is actually good news for the Trump campaign? Because it felt like even the president went into tonight almost sounding like he was managing expectations, saying things about how embarrassing it would be to lose to Biden. So what does the fact that we are all still waiting mean in terms of good news for the Trump campaign?
Well, it means that, you know, this isn't some blue, this is not looking like a blue wave at this point. You know, this is not, you know, solidly wrapped up tonight. We knew and had been, you know, saying that it was totally possible that this could go into, you know, more days and that everything might not be known tonight. But the fact that things aren't known tonight shows that, President Trump, you know, even though he did have a narrow path, all you need is one path. Right. And so far, no path has been ruled out from him for him, you know, based on AP's calls.
Well, let's talk about in particular four big battleground states. I'm talking about Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan and Arizona. Remind us why, especially in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and Michigan, we could be looking at a very long wait. What is it that happens in those particular states that means that votes are going to take a longer time to get counted?
Because they're waiting to count those critical mail-in votes. And those, you know, mail-in votes could, you know, there's a huge partisan split. And there's a thought that, you know, Biden could do much, much better in the mail-in votes in those states and creating this sort of, you know, what they called a red mirage, where if you count the votes on, you know, election day, it would look like President Trump had done really well. But then when you bring in the mail-in votes, that could change the story and that could change the direction. And so that is, you know, why those states are looking differently and why we look like we have to wait.
Right, and especially in states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, they didn't start counting those mail-in votes until at least Election Day or at least the day before Election Day. I want to ask about the coronavirus because there was so much polling in the days leading up to this election that showed widespread disapproval over the way this administration has handled the pandemic. Is it still too early to say that the pandemic ultimately didn't drive away a lot of Trump's support? What would you say?
I would say that it's still too early. We still have a ways to go to see how, you know, what impact the pandemic actually had on the vote. But what we do see is how deeply partisan this country remains and how entrenched the political differences are, so that, you know, even with all that has happened, you know, when you look at Ohio, where President Trump was up 8%, you know, and that hasn't been called yet. But if it were to be around that range, that's around the range he won Ohio in 2016. So with everything that has happened, voters still ended up in the same place. And so so that sort of thing does bring into question. But I think we have a large country and we still have a ways to go to see the real impact.
I'm curious, Aisha, you've been a political reporter for quite some time now. Did you see any distinct differences with the way President Trump campaigned in 2020 compared to the way he campaigned in 2016? Or was he essentially running the same race?
In many ways, he was running the same race, but there was a different set of grievances. I mean, his politics or his political appeal has always been about grievance. But the grievances that he was talking about in 2020 were a lot of it were sort of his personal grievances. You know, he was upset about the Russia investigation and you know, upset about media coverage and upset about, you know, so there was a lot of focus on that, upset about the way he's been, you know, covered when it comes to the coronavirus. So it was a lot about him. But he was also making the case that he was able to get a lot done before the pandemic and that he could do it again. And that if you know, that he was willing, that he had what was needed for the country to try to build the economy back up again, that he would make America great again. So he was making that argument and also still kind of running as an outsider, even though he is president.
Right. Well, given that he was running in many ways a very similar race to the one he ran in 2016, did you get the sense that there was any substantive attempt on the Trump campaign's part to expand the president's base this time around?
There was outreach to Black voters, to Latino voters, and I'm sure that they would argue that that outreach, especially to Latino voters, has paid off, you know, so far. You know, they did put out this platinum plan for, you know, for Black America, where they would, you know,
tell us about that. What was that about?
Well, they said that they would have more investment in Black businesses, that they would, you know, look at things like, you know, making Juneteenth a federal holiday, and that they would, you know, look at policing and things of that nature. But the big part of it was economic, that they would try to create, you know, millions of jobs for Black Americans and that they would invest more in Black-owned businesses. And so that was their pitch to Black voters, but it was also about, you know, really knocking down Joe Biden and making the argument that he's been around for 47 years, that he has not delivered for Black people, and therefore he does not deserve your vote. It was really less of an appeal about voting for Trump and more of an appeal against Joe Biden.
That is NPR's Ayesha Roscoe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go back to NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, are you having deja vu yet?
Sorry, all over again?
Yeah. I wasn't sure everybody would recognize that reference.
Yeah.
Being a New Yorker, I didn't want to be too sectarian about it, but
you know, I mean, I preached patience earlier in the evening, and I think that that's a thing that we have to continue to preach because, you know, given the number of mail-in ballots, there are still a lot of votes out there. You know, North Carolina, for example, is at 95% reporting. And remember, North Carolina won that case where they could have more ballots counted after Election Day, right? So there's still going to be some counting that happens. You know, one thing that's really kind of interesting here, now that California started to count votes, and there's about 60% of votes in California, Joe Biden has now pulled ahead in the popular vote by almost 2 million votes. He's up about 1.7 million votes in the popular vote, which, you know, if Biden were to go on to lose this election, that would mean 7 of the last 8 Democrats who have run for president would have won the popular vote and lost because of the Electoral College. You know, 7 of 8 would have won, and sorry, 7 of 8 would have had it, and then 3 would have lost. I don't know if I said that correctly. It's midnight, but you know, so this is it's a strange thing that's happening in the country because I'm not entirely sure that this is the way the system was designed to have this effect. I think that, you know, they wanted to, but the way that we've sorted ourselves into cities you know, other areas, it's just turned out this way.
Just give us the lay of the land again, if you would, for people who perhaps are just joining us or who just have had a chance to sort of tap in for now. When are we going to hear from some of these important swing states, given that, you know, states have different rules about when they can actually even start the counting?
Well, we're not going to know who the president-elect is tonight. I think that's pretty clear. Right now, Biden has 213 electoral votes. Trump has 118. Someone needs to get to 270 in order to cross the threshold to win a majority of the electoral votes. Now, the states in the South and the Sun Belt that Joe Biden was hoping to do well in, right now, President Trump is leading in North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas. If those were all to go Trump's way, he would still need to pick up you know, perhaps a state like Arizona. And if you were to lose Arizona, where Joe Biden is leading right now, 53-45 with about 74% of the vote in, President Trump would then start having to chip away at that blue wall once again. And we're looking at Pennsylvania and Michigan or Wisconsin as the likely suspects.
And remind us again of when 2016 was called. You've told us this several times, but for in case people didn't hear it, when was this called?
It's going to go beyond that, but the 2016 race was called at 2:29 a.m. And I bring up the popular vote, actually, because of how different this year is, because, you know, even at 3:06 a.m., Hillary Clinton was still down in the popular vote in 2016. Well, here we are at midnight, and Joe Biden's already almost a couple million votes ahead, which tells you how much further apart things are getting.
Which is why your middle name is Patience.
That's not my name.
Well,
that's not my middle name. It's never been my middle name. Like you said, I'm a New Yorker.
Exactly.
Patience, New York Minute has a definition for a reason.
Well, that's what you're aspiring to. That's what you're aspiring to. That's NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro. Let's go to Delaware, where Asma Khalid, NPR political correspondent, is with the Biden campaign, has been following the Biden campaign. Asma, are you with us?
I am.
So what are you hearing from the Biden campaign and Democratic sources?
Well, you know, we are here in a parking lot in Wilmington, Delaware, where there's a stage set up for Joe Biden to speak. And, you know, we do have a sense that the pool reporters have just been summoned. So they, in theory, are supposed to go and pick up Joe Biden from somewhere. So I would say there is some sense that we may hear from the former vice president tonight. There's a parking lot, though, you know, full of Delaware Democrats. These are the folks who have come here. They're hanging out in their cars, supporters of his. And I was talking to some of them earlier on in the night. You know, there is a sense from them that this is tight. For some of them, it's a little too tight. They would have liked a bigger margin. But they also feel like it's indicative of the fact that, you know, not much has changed this race, that everything is viewed through a partisan lens. You know, one guy I talked to said even despite the coronavirus pandemic, he's been sort of flummoxed by the fact that really even that is being seen through a partisan lens.
But what was the Biden campaign saying about its potential paths, and how do those thoughts hold up after midnight?
Yeah, you know, I will say they seemed very rosy earlier today. And I mentioned to a couple of our editors that I felt like for much of this campaign cycle, there had been this cautious optimism that they had been expressing despite what some of the polls had shown. But in the last 2 days, they sounded really upbeat. And in part because they said they were looking at their early vote data, they thought the numbers looked really good in states like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Michigan, where they felt like they had built up such an advantage in the early vote that they said Donald Trump needed to quite significantly overperform his own 2016 Election Day turnout results to actually pull off a win. So I will say, you know, one thing that the Biden campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, mentioned earlier today in a briefing was that she felt like we would know, quote, where this race is tonight. I will say, Michelle, I'm looking at the fact that we have now crossed midnight. I still don't think we have a clear sense of where this race is.
That is Asma Khalid. She's hanging in there. She's with the Biden campaign in Delaware. And you're listening to live special coverage of the 2020 election from NPR News.
This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election coverage from KALW Public Media. I'm Ben Trefney, news director at KALW. I'm joined by Sonia Narang, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Wow, really on the edge of our seats here with the national vote, huh, Sonia?
That's right.
Yeah, it's just kind of a little bit like 2016, but it does sound like we have maybe many, many hours, if not days yet, to figure out what happens. And a lot of that has to do with those mail-in ballots not being counted in some of these pivotal states. So we're going to focus in on some of our regional election issues right now. And we're joined by East Oakland reporter Janae Darden, who is going to tell us what's going on in that neck of the Bay Area. Hi, Janae.
Hi, good evening, Ben and Sonia. So I've been covering, following District 7 race, which is in deep East Oakland. And as you know, some of you may know, Councilmember Larry Reed, who has served that district for 24 years, is retiring. Mm-hmm. And his daughter, Treva, she's in the lead so far. So 7,000 votes have been counted so far, but she's in the lead with about 37.6% of the vote. Following her is Bishop Bob Jackson of Axwell Gospel Church, which is a very prominent church in East Oakland. He's in second place with about 23% of the vote. Five people, there are five candidates. So that just tells you so far how much ahead she is. And then she had an election party tonight, social distance. Her team of supporters were there, masked, including her father. And it's interesting, Ben and Sonia, I've been watching her do debates, and she hadn't mentioned her father, but yesterday she did mention that he did endorse her.
And was Larry Reed a popular representative for that district?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been there for so long and definitely well known. So, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep it in the family, maybe. We'll have to keep an eye on that in East Oakland. Thank you so much, Janae.
Thank you.
We also have David Exume with us. He is a current Audio Academy Fellow. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon. Good evening.
Good evening. So we have Oakland Measure RR on the ballot. Can you tell me a little bit about what this measure would do if it passes?
So Oakland Measure RR would remove a $1,000 limit on fines received for violating ordinances. The biggest one right now would be illegal dumping, but there's also vandalism and excessive noise and other such misdemeanors.
Exactly. So what is it looking like right now with some of the precincts reporting?
So right now, about 70,000 people have voted so far, and it looks like there's about 60% have voted yes on a Measure RR so far.
Okay, so that's a pretty big margin right there. Are you hearing any buzz on either side? What are people in support saying right now?
So supporters like Spur and council member Dan Kolb, who authored it, they're saying that the current limit does not set an adequate amount of money to deter people from committing these crimes. So higher fines will be needed to deter bad behavior and hold people accountable.
Right. And illegal dumping is an issue that's come up in Oakland and some of the other communities around the Bay Area that we've been covering, including Richmond. So, you know, do you think that this will indeed stop some of that from happening if passed?
I think it'll give companies a lot to consider. I know many consider it just the price to pay for continuing illegal dumping. So I think it'll give them a lot to consider moving forward when having to decide where to put their waste.
Right. Yeah, that's a big issue in Oakland. And are we seeing any other results coming in right now, Ben?
Well, actually, yes, we are, because the state is really turning over a lot of ballots at this point. Last break, 15 minutes ago, we said there was about 17% of precincts reporting. We're up to almost 50%, 44.5% of precincts reporting. And that means we're getting more clarity on some of these really key propositions, like Proposition 22 about app-based drivers right now. That has 57% yes vote, with nearly half of the precincts reporting. Also looking at the voting rights for people who are on parole. That is going down right now, but it's pretty close. 53% of the vote is no. Another one that I've been interested in is the bond to continue stem cell research. That one is really, really close right now, Sonia, with just 52% voting yes, but we only have about half the precincts reporting. We'll be keeping an eye on this for the rest of the night. So thank you, David. Thank you, Janae. Thank you, Sonia, for that break. And we are going to go back to NPR. You're listening to KALW special election coverage, The Bay Votes 2020. Follow our tweets at #BayVotes. We'll join you again in about 15 minutes. I'm Ben Trefney with Sonia Narang, and this is KALW San Francisco Bay Area, carrying you through all the way until the results finish at 11.
Support for NPR's elections coverage comes from Drexel University. Drexel's academic model is designed to prepare visionary leaders to address the challenges of a changing world. More at drexel.edu/ambitioncantwait.
From
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2020 election. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It is now the day after Election Day here on the East Coast, but none of the most critical swing states in the presidential contest have been called.
Former Vice President Joe Biden is leading President Trump in electoral votes, 223 to 118, but we are still waiting for calls in Pennsylvania, Florida, Arizona, and other key battleground states.
And in the Senate, Democrats are having a hard time flipping enough seats to win a majority as they had hoped. In South Carolina, Republican Lindsey Graham celebrated a win over his Democratic challenger, Jamie Harrison.
I owe so much to so many, not just in South Carolina, throughout the country. So thank you. This victory is an answer to a lot of prayers.
Now, Democrats are expected to hold on to the House of Representatives. We will turn now to NPR voting reporter Miles Parks. Hi, Miles.
Hey there.
Hey there. But before we get into it, I do want to, it looks like we have a call to make. The Associated Press has called the state of Ohio a key battleground state for President Trump. Again, the Associated Press has called Ohio for President Trump. All right, so let's get into it, Miles. You are our election security and voting reporter, or one of them. Tell us what election officials have been saying about when will we have results in some of these key swing states that we're still waiting on.
You know, I don't think it's exactly what anyone who's listening to this wants to hear, but it's just people are just preaching patience right now. And it's something that they've been talking about. Election officials have been talking about really for months as it looked, you know, as the pandemic took hold and we knew that there was going to be more and more mail voting. And we know how long mail voting takes to count in some of these states. And we're seeing that, you know, if you zoom in. Philadelphia is a good example. In Pennsylvania, these election officials were not able to start processing any of these absentee ballots until today. They've counted about 76...
By state law, right?
By state law, exactly. Mm-hmm. A lot of states have adjusted their state laws to allow election officials to open those ballots or process them early. Some states have not done that. Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin are among those states. So
I'm just going to interrupt you real quick, Miles.
Sure,
so we have another call to make. The Associated Press has called Iowa for President Trump. Again, that the Associated Press has called Iowa for President Trump. Sorry, go right ahead, Miles.
Yeah, so just with Philadelphia, I think it's a good example in terms of as voters are trying to kind of visualize exactly how many of these absentee ballots election officials are kind of inundated with. Philadelphia officials have counted about 76,000 of them. They can count about 10,000 per hour, but they expect to receive up to 400,000 of these absentee ballots. So you can kind of do the math on that.
Yeah.
They're not going to be done counting those absentee ballots in Philadelphia for at least a few days.
And we're expecting, we can talk about this a little later, but we're expecting Pennsylvania to potentially be a hot spot for litigation after this election day, aren't we?
Yeah, it definitely could be. And as Trevor Potter was saying a second ago, if the margins are close here, that's really where we could see a situation where we might not know who won the presidency for a couple of days if it comes down to Pennsylvania specifically. And then if Pennsylvania comes down to just a few thousand votes, you know, election officials don't even have all of the absentee ballots that can count in their hands yet. They can receive absentee ballots as long as they were postmarked by Election Day, up to 3 days after Election Day in Pennsylvania. So there still could be ballots that get to election officials.
The Supreme Court let that stand, at least for now.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so you have reported on the potential for disinformation when it comes to this whole counting process. What are we seeing there in terms of how much disinformation there has been and how much more we might expect to see? What do you think?
Right. So it hasn't really picked up yet. We're still in the very beginnings of this process. You know, polls have just really finished closing. But national security election officials are on the lookout for this. They've been warning about this for the past few weeks. There's a rumor control section of the Department of Homeland Security's website that specifically talks about the possibility of election results taking a little bit of time and rumors, basically misinformation, spreading in that time because it is just such a fertile ground for misinformation for people to either sow doubt in the results because they're taking time, because Americans, by and large, don't have a great understanding of the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts of how votes are counted and the transparent processes that kind of go into that. So when people spread lies about, you know, what's happening in this time between people actually casting the votes and the tallies being announced, those can sometimes be really successful. At this point, we haven't seen it, but, you know, over the last couple of weeks, President Trump specifically has been somebody who has shared a lot of this misinformation about the counting process. It'll be curious to see whether that continues in the next few hours and days.
All right. That is NPR's Miles Parks. Thank you, Miles.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go now to Daniel Kurtzleben and NPR political reporter Daniel Kurtzleben and NPR senior political editor and correspondent Ron Elving. But we have a number of calls to sort of bring you up to date on. As we just heard, Ohio goes to President Trump, and that's a big one. Because you can see that former Vice President Joe Biden made a big play for Ohio. And it's very interesting because a former governor, John Kasich, for example, went so far as to speak at the Democratic convention in support of Joe Biden's candidacy, really sort of opposing Donald Trump. And Iowa is also for Trump. And then Minnesota goes for Joe Biden. And President Trump wins Montana. So, Ron, do you want to start? Tell us your thoughts about that.
Thought it would be first that these are two states that earlier tonight had been surprisingly strong for Joe Biden, and that is a bit of what we would call a blue mirage. Now, we've heard a lot about the red mirage in some of these states and the blue wave that might follow, but in this case and in tonight, several different states of importance, we have seen an early blue mirage where it looked like the state might be close, might be competitive, where perhaps Joe Biden might have a shot. And obviously, had he been able to pick up Ohio, that would ease the pain to some degree of losing Florida, if he is going to lose Florida. And it would also put a little less pressure on Pennsylvania. So that would have been a big one. Iowa, 6 electoral votes, not quite as big. But nonetheless, both of those states were looking more promising. And then as more votes were counted that were just cast today, they discovered that President Trump had survived in both states without too terribly much trouble.
Danielle, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, look, those states you just talked about, Ohio and Iowa, one thing that I have been watching in Iowa, and not just because it's my home state and I watch it closely anyway, is that Iowa had a large number in 2016 of those Obama-Trump swing counties, those counties that had voted for Obama, but then voted for Trump. And just looking anecdotally through some of the biggest swing counties in Iowa that were the biggest in 2016, some of them went even more for Donald Trump now than they did in 2016. So some of those voters, at least in Iowa, we don't want to extrapolate too much from this, but at least in Iowa, some of those voters that Biden, I'm sure, wanted to and thought maybe he could pick up because Obama had, he just didn't.
And I think if we can, I'd like to go to Scott Detrow, who is with the Biden campaign in Delaware. Scott, can you hear us?
I can. Okay. I am in Joe Biden's motorcade right now. He is making his way from his house to the Chase Center in Wilmington, where Biden had hoped to give a victory speech tonight. He is making his way there in a very large, very fast-moving motorcade. This will, of course, not be a victory speech. This is a very close race right now. You mentioned several states that just went President Trump's way. But I will tell you, Democrats feel more confident than they did just a couple of hours ago. They feel good about Arizona. And Democrats I'm talking to in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania feel very confident that when all the votes are counted, he will be ahead. But when all the votes are counted is key. It's clear that's going to take several days. And Joe Biden feels like he needs to make a statement at this point in time. A lot of Democrats feel like Hillary Clinton made a mistake not speaking on election night 4 years ago. We're going to be hearing from Joe Biden very shortly.
And why do they think it was a mistake for Hillary Clinton not to speak up earlier, 4 years ago? The polls have all closed pretty much at this point. So what is the strategic importance of saying something at this point? What point is he hoping to make since he can't claim victory yet?
That's right, and he's absolutely not going to do that by all indications. And I think actually Al Gore might be the better reference than Hillary Clinton, because, of course, the next morning Hillary Clinton did concede that race. Democrats are very worried about what will happen in the coming days if mail-in ballots are being counted slowly, as they likely will be, given the way President Trump has tried to cast doubt on that process. Joe Biden is most likely, given all indications of what he said before, going to make the case. This is a legitimate vote count. It is going to take time. And I see a path to victory.
And what are they saying in sort of response to kind of the noise? I mean, one of the things that has been anticipated that we've all talked about, all the political reporters have talked about, the networks have all talked about, is the idea of somebody prematurely from a campaign, let's say hypothetically, claims victory, even in a state, before we're ready to call it, before the Associated Press calls it, because that we are following their analysis. What sure. is the what is sort of the sense of how that should be addressed on the Biden side?
On the Biden side, I don't mm-hmm. think you've seen them. Well, I guess I should say they haven't had many opportunities mm-hmm. to. Certainly, he's ahead in Arizona right now. You have seen the Trump campaign push back hard on Fox News, which is the only major news outlet, to project that Biden has won Arizona. They're saying that is a mistake. The vote seems to be narrowing a little, but we were waiting for more votes to come into Arizona. Biden has said repeatedly over the last few days, as we've heard this message from President Trump, that the president doesn't decide who the next president is. The people decide. Biden has placed a lot of faith in the voters of the United States, and I don't expect that to change, even though he is looking at a much smaller margin than he was expecting.
And the tea leaf reading is always so complicated. It's always so complicated when you're covering a campaign, because on the one hand, you have a lot of exposure to the candidates and their advisors and so forth. On the other hand, you're sort of in this bubble. And you're sure. susceptible to, I mean, everybody's trying to play the ref, right? Like, who are we kidding? Sure. But as near as you can, Scott, what is your sense of the mood there?
Certainly, I would say anxious but confident. I keep getting some variation of cautiously optimistic over and over again. I'm talking to a lot of state-level people in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, two states that I know pretty well. I haven't been in touch on the state level as much in the other okay. states, but in those two states, cautiously optimistic. Though I'll say again, we're going to say this a billion times, places like Milwaukee and Philadelphia are going to be counting their votes slowly over the next few days because they weren't able to start counting those mail-in ballots until today.
Thanks, Scott Detrow. If I could bring in both Ron Elving and Daniel Kurtzleben back into this panel. Ron, you have been through so many presidential elections, and there's always been a problem with polling. Polling was especially off in 2016, and then we were told throughout this campaign year in 2020 that a lot of the oversights in polling that had happened in 2016, a lot of the mistakes were corrected for in 2020. Democrats came into this night super excited for a much bigger lead for Biden, you know, with the caveat that we could still be waiting, but at least something a little bit, you know, signs of better fortunes earlier on. What do you think is going on tonight? What does it show us about the problems with polling still, and how much we shouldn't put too much weight into, oh, wow, Biden has a huge lead? What do you think?
Clearly, too much faith has been put in the polls, because the polls are just not the decider of these things. The people who are polled are the people who agree to be polled. And we have seen again and again strong evidence that when it comes to Donald Trump, it's very hard to find his voters and get them willing to be interviewed. Now, that's not to say that none of them will. It's only to say that marginally they are more resistant to being polled. They don't trust the media. They don't like the pollsters. Maybe they don't like the voice they hear on the telephone. They don't want to share any personal information. And so they break off and they don't get polled. So I think we're undercounting Trump voters. Polls in respect to other kinds of races, other kinds of elections at all levels in the country are still doing pretty well. But when Donald Trump gets involved, or when he's very heavily involved on behalf of a candidate other than himself, that tends to throw the polls off.
Mm-hmm. So is it still too early at this point in the night, given that so many key battleground states haven't been called? Is it early to say the polling got it wrong, or is it more just, you know, the product of a lot of votes just haven't been counted? What is happening? Why are we still waiting? What do you think?
We're seeing a parallel to 2016 in another respect, and that is that the national poll numbers will probably not be that far off. Once we get all the votes counted, Joe Biden did pretty well in Texas and some other places where Hillary Clinton did not. He's probably going to have several million votes more than she had in margin over Donald Trump. So in other words, the popular vote will have been even greater for the Democrat than it was in 2016. And in 2016, it was extraordinarily high, 3 million. So that part of the polling does not seem to have been wildly off. It might be off a couple of points. Where there were problems were in, for example, Florida, which many pollsters saw going to Joe Biden, right. Not by a lot, but by 2 or 3 or 4 percentage points. And it does not seem to be the case tonight, where we are tonight in Florida. And that would be true of several other states as well, North Carolina, perhaps, and some others. So state by state, the polls had a lot to answer for in 2016, and that may be the case again this year.
Not very reassuring. Daniel Kurtzleben, I want to bring you in because you've been looking at a lot of the AP vote cast data. This is the extensive voter survey data the AP has been analyzing going into this election. And I want to talk right now about some of the key groups that we are watching. You know, we've been talking a lot about Black voters, Latino voters, women, but let's just start with white people without college degrees. I'm curious, how substantial do white voters without college degrees, how substantially do they play in the key battleground states we are still waiting on, places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania?
Oh, they're absolutely a huge group in those states. And really, this is one of those electoral shifts you cannot overstate, is the absolute widening of this gulf between college and non-college, and especially white non-college and white college-educated people. And
I just need to jump in because we have a huge call right now. The AP has called Florida for President Trump. Again, just as Ron Elving was saying, Florida was leaning towards President Trump. The Associated Press has indeed called Florida for President Trump. That brings the electoral college votes to, if I'm not mistaken, looking here at my election results page, President Trump now has 174 electoral votes to Joe Biden's 223.
This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election coverage from KALW Public Media. Just heard that news that President Trump has won Florida, according to AP. Now, we do need to keep in mind that there are a lot of ballots yet to be counted. And just because a news source makes a declaration does not necessarily mean that it is true. But that is what AP has declared at this point. I'm Ben Trefney, news director of KALW. I'm joined by Sonia Narang, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Good evening, Sonia.
Good evening, Ben.
And we're going to go back to NPR's coverage of the national races at 10 p.m., but we have a lot to cover regionally, including the first results from the city and county of San Francisco, and we're going to start running through some of those right now. Proposition A, which will help fund health and homelessness parks and streets bonds, that has a 72% yes vote, and because it's a bond measure, then that means it has to get two-thirds of the vote, and it is winning so far. The creation of a Department of Sanitation and Streets is also winning with 61% of the yes vote. Now, keep in mind, there are results that are yet to be counted, but this is with about 61% of the votes counted at this point. There is one of these police reform measures, including a new sheriff's oversight commission, that is passing with 68% of the vote at this point. Also, a measure that would reduce the mandate to staff police at a certain level is dominating with 72% of the vote right now. Sonia, we have some more results because there were a lot of ballot measures in San Francisco.
Yeah, there were quite a few. So Proposition G, which is a prop that would allow for youth to vote in local elections, is super close. It's about 50% no right now. We're going to have to keep an eye on that one. We also have Prop H, which would allow for neighborhood commercial districting and city permitting processes to get easier. That is a little more on the yes side, with 62.17% saying yes. The next one we have is Prop I in San Francisco. That's a real estate transfer tax. Prop I is also a little bit in favor of yes, with about 59% in favor. Prop G, which is an important one, it's a parcel tax for the San Francisco Unified School District.
Just to clarify, Prop J.
Prop J, sorry. Mm-hmm. Prop J is overwhelmingly yes right now, with about 76% in favor.
And this is something that we should also note. The KALW's license is held by the San Francisco Unified School District, and the school district has been getting quite a lot of criticism lately for not creating a reopening plan. It was actually just written up in the New York Times. One more that I want to note here is Proposition L, which would actually create a tax based on comparison of the top executives' pay to employees' pay. Well, San Franciscans are saying, yes, we want to make sure to do something about that 1%, and 66% of people are saying, yes, let's pass that. And another thing that I really want to note here, Sonia, is that there are a lot of candidates who are running for office in San Francisco. Some interesting races, like Scott Wiener for state senator, is leading by about three-fifths of the vote over Jackie Fielder. Also, for the Board of Education, that San Francisco Unified School District that we were just talking about, with about 61% of the votes counted, Jenny Lamb, Mark Sanchez, Kaveen Bogus, and Matt Alexander so far have the lead, but Alita Fisher and Michelle Parker are not too far behind at this point. And one more race that I want to call attention to is for Community College Board. Again, there are going to be four candidates who get in. Chanel Williams, Tom Temprano, Aaliyah Chisti, and Alan Wong are in the lead, but Anita Martinez is right behind. And because we still have about 40% of the vote yet to count, this is still all up in the air, Sonia.
Yeah, it's something that we're going to have to keep watching. For now, I'd like to bring on one of our special guests. We have Malik Washington with us. Malik is assistant editor at San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper. Hi, Malik.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Malik. Yeah, it's good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you, Malik. And Malik, I know a lot of your work and your coverage at the San Francisco Bayview newspaper focuses on youth. And you've been making sure that the city and county invests in youth. So can you tell me about some of San Francisco's ballot measures that you're watching closely, especially the ones that will help the youth?
Well, really, in order to clarify what I'm really focused on right now, is there seems to be a really gross underfunding of the City College of San Francisco. And that is just really one of the forefront issues that we've been focusing on at the San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper. And that's why we're really, really interested in this board race with where you say Anita Martinez is kind of just scrapping. She's being real scrappy, and hopefully she'll stick around.
Yeah, she's just behind. She has about 10% of the vote right now, and she's just behind Alan Wong, who has about 11%, Malik.
Yeah, well, like I said, we've been having a real problem in the Bayview area. You know, we're in the Bayview, the San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper.
Right.
We represent Bayview, Hunters Point, and we've really been having a pronounced problem with underfunding of our main campus on Oakdale. And that's and it's hurting the kids. I mean, if you look at the front cover of our newspaper for the November, you'll see a group of CCSF students and a couple faculty members posted up in front of a mural on 3rd and Palou. And the problem is that we've just really been not seem to be getting the attention of the mayor's office when it comes to funding City College of San Francisco. I mean, it's like we're in the defunding zone rather than the funding. And I am intimately familiar with the detrimental effect of lack of advanced education in communities of color. We are trying to destroy the school to prison pipeline, not mm-hmm. continue to pave it. And the way that we stop the school to prison pipeline is to create opportunities for higher education within communities of color. It's been proven that when anyone has an access to a good college education, they actually, you know, they just don't go into criminal activity.
Right.
And this is just so important right now. That's just one of the most paramount issues with the youth, is just that we fund our schools, that we give them access to a quality education, and that whether you are living in a high rental or a high real estate area, whether you are poor or rich, you should still have an opportunity to a good education.
And right. You've talked about investing in teaching children and making sure they're prepared for jobs of the future. You've also talked about making sure that money can go into schools. And some of that perhaps means, maybe moving or shifting money away from police. Are you watching some of the police measures carefully around California?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's when we say a lot of people have a misconception of when we say defund the police. yes, we are saying defund the police because we are spending billions and billions of dollars of over-policing a lot of our oppressed and minority communities. Let's take that money and invest it in community centers that not just have recreational activities, but have maybe some pilot program for coding. You know, we really have to look towards the future and teach and provide opportunities for our children to learn the skills of the future. So I really think that's something that's important in our communities right now.
One other thing, Malik, that we are watching here is the possible elimination of the money bail system in California. Prop 25, with about 45% of the precincts reporting around the state, looks like it would be going down. It's got 54% of the no vote right now. What would you think about that concept of eliminating the money bail system?
Wow, I am so glad that you asked me about that. You know, for us that are, you know, activists, advocates, journalists, we were kind of excited about the, you know, the abolishing of money bail. But this particular proposition is very, very confusing. There's a lot of ambiguous language in there. And I would have to tell your listeners that there is a very controversial and racist algorithm that is being used to replace the money bail. And this algorithm is actually very discriminatory to racial, you know, towards people of color. So that's why we are really not for Proposition 25, because it, although it might abolish money bail, this algorithm that the city has been using and that these police agencies have been using is very, very detrimental towards communities of color. So it's not the, you know, holy grail, or it's not something that we were really advocating for, this Prop 25. We want to maybe go back to the drawing board and draw up something that is more inclusive and something that is not so discriminatory towards people of color.
Thank you so much for that insight, Malik. This is Malik Washington, who is an assistant editor with the San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper. We appreciate your time tonight. And we have reported on some of the algorithms that are in play around the possible replacement of money bail. You could find that at kalw.org. And now we're going to go ahead and turn to Berkeley. The city of Berkeley has obviously results coming in, and one that we are looking at is Mayor Jesse Aragin. Looks like he will probably be reelected. He has about two-thirds of the vote with a partial count going on right now, and we're joined now by Carla Estevez, who is part of KLW's Audio Academy, class of 21. And which ballot measure are you paying attention to there, Carla?
Hi, Ben. Yeah, so I am paying attention to Berkeley Measure KK, and it looks like all 33 precincts in Berkeley have reported, and Measure KK has effectively passed. So that updates Berkeley City Charter with a hodgepodge of four different things, ranging from updating firefighter residency requirements to removing gendered language from the city charter.
And thank you very much for that. Have you seen what would you anticipate would happen if the results continue this way?
I anticipate that it will pass just because it was put on the ballot by a unanimous city council and mayor. And also, there was never an official argument ever submitted against Measure KK. So it looks like they've pretty much sealed a yes vote on that.
All right. Thank you very much. Carla Estevez, who's covering Berkeley Measure KK. From KLW's Audio Academy class.
Yeah, we also have with us Andrew Garcia, who is also a member of the Audio Academy class. Andrew, you've been looking into Berkeley Measure II, which is a police accountability measure. Can you tell us a little bit about what it would do?
Hey, Sonia. Yeah, I have. So Berkeley has had police accountability since the 70s, but a lot of folks are saying it needs updating. So Measure II would give it a fresh new name, the Berkeley Accountability Board, but it will also give the public longer deadlines to file complaints and give the board access to documents and even subpoena officer testimony.
Right. Now, in addition to, you know, changing the name, is there any real reason for passing Measure II? It's one of several police oversight measures around the county this election.
I think many of the proponents in Berkeley, even the current police review commission that exists in Berkeley, is saying a lot of its access to police documents, its ability to do informed research of complaints is vastly overdated or outdated. And so it would really update it to bring it up to par with a lot of other progressive reforms that have been made recently around the Bay Area.
Right. And what are people who are in favor of it saying right now as results come in?
There's not a lot, a lot of crickets on around social media on this one, but a lot of people that are for it include local chapters of the ACLU, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, and even some national police reforms leading up into the election have all tweeted out their support for Measure II.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for being here to share more about this measure.
Thank you.
And I'd like to give an update on a few more Berkeley measures. Measure MM has passed that asks if landlords should be prohibited from evicting tenants for not paying rent during a state or local emergency. That passed with a 54% yes vote. Also, Berkeley Measure GG passed that would tax rides from ride apps that originate in Berkeley. And that passed with a 60% yes vote. That, of course, makes me think of Prop 22, which now, with as I update and see that about 50% of precincts are partially reporting, Prop 22 is passing with 57% of the vote so far. And, of course, we are waiting for more results to come in, as we are with the presidential race and the Senate races from around the country. But at this point now, we would like to introduce another guest, who is Melissa Perez-Winder, is a reporter at Richmond Confidential, run by the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Well, you've been covering the Richmond City Council races. And of course, when I think of Richmond and I think of politics, I think of money and I think of Chevron. And so I'm wondering if you know how the Chevron-backed City Council candidates have fared there.
This year, most of the corporate money and non-grassroots money came from police unions. And so a vast majority of some of the candidates that were not on the progressive slate received anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 in money from different development, California real estate lobby, and the state land lobby as well.
What are you seeing, Melissa, as results right now?
It looks like the Richmond Progressive Alliance, who ran one candidate in each of the three races that were open, have pretty much swept the Richmond City Council race this year. All three other candidates won with a really big percentage point ahead from the second person. And I think that we're going to pretty much see a return of the Richmond Progressive Alliance taking over control of the Richmond City Council.
Right. And for those not familiar with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, or RPA for short, can you tell us what they stand for? What positions are they running on?
Yeah, the Richmond Progressive Alliance is a progressive group that is concerned with issues like the environment, policing, renters' rights. And I was able to briefly speak with Gail McLaughlin, who ran on District 6, and she believed that corporations, landlords have spent twice as much promoting their candidates, but that the Richmond people are ready to stand for working families and to bring back a progressive slate.
Okay. And Melissa, we've also been looking at one of the local measures. This is Richmond Measure U, which essentially changes the business tax structure. Do you know how that's faring right now, if you've been looking at results, and how would it affect local businesses in Richmond?
Yeah, so I believe that Measure U is ahead at this point, and it will impact some Richmond businesses who have spoken out against it, saying that this is not the right time to increase taxes on businesses since they're coping with the COVID pandemic. Others point out to the fact that Richmond has a $6 million deficit right now, and this tax would bring approximately $6 million to the city. So,
well, thank you so much, Melissa, and thanks for sharing some news from Richmond. We appreciate it. We're going to move over to East Palo Alto in the South Bay. We have Lena Potts with us, and Lena serves as the director of one of our community partners. That is the East Palo Alto branch of the Boys and Girls Club. Hi, Lena.
Hi, y'all. Thank you so much for having me tonight.
Well, thank you. I know you work with a lot of families in East Palo Alto that are struggling to afford the basics. You know, we're looking at being in the middle of a pandemic, and these are families that are trying to make their ends meet, and they're trying to afford housing and food. How is East Palo Alto's measure to fund affordable housing going to impact the community you work in?
Yeah, you know, affordable housing is, I would say, one of the most pressing issues, particularly since the pandemic hit the local community so hard that I've seen in East Palo Alto. But truly, it's been an issue that's been top of mind for residents for years and years. I've worked in the local community for 5 years, and I've lived in and around the community for 9. And I can just say it's always been sort of the first thing that I've heard out of people's mouths is that the gentrification in the local area is something that scares people and saddens people. And so affordable housing is absolutely top of mind for people. I've been really impressed and excited to see people so engaged this election cycle and excited to get out and vote this year.
Right. What have you been seeing in terms of turnout this time around?
Yeah, you know, our positionality is interesting at a Boys and Girls Club because normally we're working with so many young people, right? And the vast majority of the folks that we're able to work with directly aren't able to vote. And then obviously our work has changed tremendously over the course of the last 8 months. And now we're interfacing a lot more with the local community. And we've just seen so much demand for resources, for information about voting, for multilingual information about voting. So it's clear that turnout is a lot higher. I was outside the Boys and Girls Club this evening serving dinner, and I had 6 different people come up to me and ask if we were a polling place. The only reason we weren't a polling place is because we served dinner every night and we couldn't do both. But so the demand feels high.
That's incredible that you have to choose serving food over helping people vote. The fact that you have to make that choice is a really difficult one.
Yeah, it was a tough one for us, you know, but we're lucky that we were able to direct people to a polling place right around the corner. So that's nice that there are enough local spots for folks.
I'm curious, too, because I was last week in East Oakland at a food pantry where there are so many volunteers mm-hmm. who are doing really extraordinary work. And they told me that they thought that their numbers might have doubled since the pandemic began as far as the number of people who they were serving. And for those people who don't really know, how is the situation now that we're moving into, what, month 8 or something like that of the pandemic mm-hmm. and the economic hardships people are facing?
Yeah, it's been a real eye-opener for me personally. We were aware of food insecurity as an issue for our local community. That was obvious to us. But I don't think the scope was, particularly because, you know, it's great that you bring up the food pantry example. That's not our regular scope of work. That's not our area of expertise, right? And so we went into it sort of on a whim. We said to ourselves, we have chefs, we have commercial kitchens, we can't have kids in the building en masse. And so why wouldn't we utilize our resources in this new way? It seemed really straightforward and easy, and now it's 8 months later. And one of the most striking things that I think I've learned is how much demand there must have been before the pandemic. It's clear to us that there are sort of two populations of folks we're serving with our daily dinner service. One group of people who are food insecure and otherwise just wouldn't know where they were getting their next meal. And then there's another population of folks. Oh, I'm sorry?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was just saying, and then there's another population of folks who maybe they're not facing direct food insecurity, but they're facing such dramatic financial insecurity that not having to worry about spending their money putting a meal on the table for their family relieves that financial burden otherwise.
Well, these are some really important issues that we're going to continue to follow even after the election. So we will definitely be reaching out to you more, Lena. We very much appreciate you being here with us tonight. That's Lena Potts, director of the East Palo Alto branch of the Boys and Girls Club.
Thank you. Y'all have a great night.
Thank you, Lena.
Well, I want to give an update on some highlights so far of the state reporting that we have. Over 50% of precincts reporting right now. And earlier I had misreported something that restores the right to vote after a prison term is actually leading with 60% of the vote. That's Prop 17. But another one, Prop 18, which would give 17-year-olds the right to vote in primaries, is losing with 53% of people saying no. And the possibility, as I mentioned, of eliminating the money bail system is going down with 54% of people voting no. with just over half the returns in. You're listening to KLW's special election coverage, The Bay Votes 2020. I'm KLW News Director Ben Trefney with Sonia Narung. We are going back to NPR. This is KLW San Francisco Bay Area. We'll join you again in 15 minutes.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2020 election. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Sarah McCammon. Not long ago, the AP called Florida, Ohio, and Iowa for President Trump and Minnesota for Joe Biden. We are still waiting on results in several other key swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina.
And we may be waiting a while longer. Right now, Joe Biden has 223 electoral votes, and President Trump has 174. Though with so many critical swing states still too early to call, the direction of the race is still unclear.
Former Vice President Biden spoke moments ago and delivered a brief but optimistic message.
We feel good about where we are. We really do. I'm here to tell you tonight, we believe we're on track to win this election.
Well, President Trump tweeted that he will also speak later on this evening, and we will be here for all of that.
And I want to bring in our colleague, NPR senior political editor correspondent, Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Sarah.
And in addition to tweeting that he was going to speak later this evening, this morning, we're into the morning now, at least on the East Coast, President Trump is falsely claiming victory. Twitter has already flagged his tweet because he's claiming he's won, which he has not. As we know, the results are still very much undecided. As you look at the map, what are you seeing right now? What are you watching?
Well, you know, look, we're looking for, with Arizona with 78% of the vote in, Joe Biden is up by 8 points there or so, 7.5 points. And, you know, kind of waiting to see what the Associated Press does. I think they're waiting to see how many of those votes were in person to be able to make a call or not. We're waiting on Nevada also tonight to see how either candidate does. Obviously, that's big for either candidate. But, you know, look, President Trump's math actually gets a little complicated if Joe Biden winds up winning Arizona, and even if Trump gets Texas, Georgia, and North Carolina. You know, if Biden were to pick up Wisconsin and Michigan and that one electoral vote in Nebraska, he doesn't even need Pennsylvania, to be able to win this election. So, you know, I think the worm is turning a little bit here. I think Joe Biden probably did what he needed to do as far as calming some of the nerves of some of the some jittery nerves of some Democrats. Who don't know exactly what to make of these results at this point. And, you know, for President Trump to sort of say, you know, it's kind of expected. This whole outcome is very predictable, where we knew President Trump and his team had signaled that they would say that the election was being stolen from him and that votes can't be cast after the election. No votes are being cast after the polls have closed. There are states that get to count their votes, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, for example, that, still have votes to count that were mailed in either before the election or postmarked by Election Day.
Which we saw a lot of litigation surrounding in the days leading up to the election.
And totally legal and completely within the realm of what happens in every presidential election, except this election has far more volume of mail-in votes. Normally it doesn't matter all that much, but that's where we have all this mail-in vote this time. You know, it's just one of those things where, like, you know, you run a mile on a track, it's four laps, right? You can't stop after three laps and say you won.
Like, even if you're ahead, seem to be ahead, or might not be ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you don't do that, and you can't do it. You'd be disqualified, or you'd finish last, or whatever, right? But, like, that's kind of what we're seeing. This is what the fight is going to be. This is exactly, in a lot of ways, what we expected. I think that for the Biden campaign, they were hoping to pick off a North Carolina, hoping to pick off one of these, North Carolina, Arizona, Texas, maybe Florida, although they weren't feeling as good about Florida coming into tonight as North Carolina, frankly, for example. They thought they picked up North Carolina and Arizona, they wouldn't have to worry about dealing with the late ballots coming in a Pennsylvania.
Right. That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro with a look at where the race stands right now.
All right. And I want to bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hey, Tam.
Hello.
Hello. Long night for you, as expected, I guess. Well, we just heard from the president for the first time tonight, unsurprisingly, on Twitter. Can you just recap for us, what did he say tonight?
There are two tweets, one of which has been obscured by Twitter because it contains misleading information about an election. In that tweet, he says, "We are up big, but we are trying, but they are trying to steal the election. We will never let them do it. Votes cannot be cast after the polls are closed." As Domenico was discussing, the president there is garbling how the election process works, and the fact is that in many states, ballots received that are postmarked by election day but are received up to a couple of days afterwards still count, these absentee and mail ballots. And so there are some key states where there are those ballots that are still yet to be counted. The other note is that the president will be making a statement tonight. He adds a big win! Exclamation point. Now, of course, he has not won the race for re-election at this point. However, he did win in Florida, according to the AP call.
Right.
He could
Wait, so
be
when
referring
he said a big
to
win,
that,
that's what I was going to ask you.
It
was
is
he
a,
saying he won the election or he won Florida? You know,
it is a big win. I don't think that he is declaring full-on victory in the Electoral College because there is no map that has him winning yet.
Right.
Though his team remains optimistic, they are concerned about what looks, you know, what looks like maybe a rougher night in Arizona than they were hoping for. And two other states that had been on the president's stretch list, his reach list, states that he lost very, very narrowly in 2016 and really thought that they could win this time, Minnesota and New Hampshire. Both of those have been called for Joe Biden.
Can you talk about the importance of Florida? There was a lot of talk going into tonight that if President Trump were to lose Florida, it would be a very, very, very hard election for him to win. Can you talk about Florida?
Yeah, so Florida was essentially a must-win for President Trump. I mean, there were a couple of scenarios where he could lose Florida and still win, but they were not easy scenarios. So Florida was incredibly important for his campaign, and he campaigned there extensively. He also changed his residence to Florida and became a Florida man, I think about a year ago, and has been describing it as his home state. That's where Mar-a-Lago is, where he calls the Winter White House. And the campaign really put a lot of emphasis on winning over Cuban and Venezuelan American
voters. Hold on to that thought. I want to talk about that. But we have another call tonight to make. The Associated Press has called Texas for President Trump. Texas has gone to President Trump, according to the AP. Tam, before you continue on the Latino vote in Florida, talk about Texas, because Joe Biden really made a play for Texas, really thought he had a shot at that state. What do you think this shows us?
I don't know if they really, really, really thought that they had a chance at Texas. They did throw enough money. I mean, they had money coming out of their ears. So they did throw a little money into running ads in Texas. Senator and vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris campaigned there. But Texas was not one of those states where Joe Biden was spending all of his time or really any time. But Democrats were hopeful that they could move Texas. And, you know, Texas is one of those states that is demographically changing, where
right.
Democrats feel that eventually it will be theirs.
Right. But though it's been a solidly red state for many election cycles.
For many, many election cycles. And it's often one of these states that Democrats reach for but can't quite reach. And that is what happened again tonight. Though one thing that we continue to watch is down ballot. What is happening in some of the suburban congressional districts?
Well, I want to go back to your thought on Florida. The fact that President Trump won Florida, I guess there are two groups of voters that jumped into my brain about, you know, how they were able to still be won over by the Trump campaign. Let's talk about the Latino electorate in Florida. We've been saying all night that this is not just a one-block voting electorate, that the Latino community across the United States is diverse. Could you talk about how Latino voters tend to vote in Florida and why?
Well, and if you watched the Republican convention, then you would know that the Trump campaign had a very direct message for Cuban and Venezuelan voters in Florida. And that message was, socialism is terrible. Joe Biden knows socialists or associates with socialists. And of course, Joe Biden makes it very clear he is not a socialist or a democratic socialist. He is his own man, and he ran as a moderate in the primaries anyway. But this anti-socialism message, the Trump campaign kept hitting that and hitting that and hitting that, and particularly targeting both Spanish language and also African-American media, radio, trying to peel off some of that support that Hillary Clinton had. And if you look at Miami-Dade County, Joe Biden did not do as well as Hillary Clinton did in that Democratic and diverse county, and that helped President Trump.
Interesting. That is NPR's Tamara Key. Thank you, Tam.
You're welcome.
And we're going to go now to Jennifer Morrell. She's a partner at the Elections Group, which works with state and local elections officials who are very busy tonight. And she's a former local election official herself. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, you bet. Thank you for having me.
Can you give our listeners a sense, first of all, based on your experience, of why it's taking so long for us to get results in some of these key states tonight?
You bet. You know, I think when we talk about this expansion of mail ballots, it often is boiled down to something as simple as opening them, but there are a lot of various security measures and checks and protocols, counting that happens throughout that process. So it's a very slow, methodical process, despite a tremendous amount of for how they could expand that in a way that would be as efficient as possible. So I think they've done really well. Again, it's just in any set of circumstances, I think we would be waiting.
Yeah, we are seeing delays in several key places, including in Pennsylvania. But as you've said, not a lot of reports of major issues, despite really an unprecedented level of early voting and absentee voting because of the pandemic. Why do you think it has been relatively smooth, perhaps surprisingly smooth compared to what was predicted?
Oh, my goodness. So much time and effort and energy. These officials have been working, honestly, nonstop, 7 days a week, 12, 14 hours a day. They've been bringing in extra staff. They've had groups and organizations like ours there to support where it's needed. It's honestly been a tremendous amount of effort on their part. And I think they've, because they've been under the spotlight so much and under, some scrutiny and criticism, I think there's also been a real determination to show the nation, to show the world that they are professionals. They are going to do this right. They're going to get it done. They're going to get the job done with integrity, with efficiency, and have an election that we can feel confident in.
That's Jennifer Morrell, a partner at the Elections Group, which works with state and local elections officials, those very, very busy officials tonight. Thank you so much for your time, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You are listening to live special coverage of the 2020 election from NPR News.
You're listening to NPR's coverage on KALW Public Media. This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election coverage for November 3rd. I'm Ben Trefney, news director here at the station, joined by Sonia Narang, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Sonia, we've been on the air for over 2 hours now, and KALW has been on the air for over six. You hanging in there?
Yeah, it's been great talking to so many different people tonight.
Absolutely, and a little bit of fresh air from the national coverage. It's so intense. But we will be going back to National Public Radio in about 4 minutes. But first, we're going to focus on some regional election coverage, and specifically on Alameda County. We're joined by Lisa Ramrica, who is part of the Audio Academy class of 2021. And Lisa, what are you focusing on tonight?
Hi, Ben. Yes, so I've been following Measure W, Alameda County, and that's a measure that would introduce 0.5% sales tax increase for the next 10 years to fund homelessness services across the county.
And how's that measure doing right now?
That is a really great question. So it is really tight. All the districts have just returned, and the figures in are 51% in favor. So a really kind of tight, decision for that.
And so I imagine that because of the vote-by-mail situation, that even though they have counted all of these ballots to this point, that there are still some that could be delivered, right, Lisa?
Yeah, sure. So that will be, kind of like something to watch for the next kind of day or so. And there's been a lot of, controversy around this because it is a fund that would, a tax that would actually put funds into a general fund. So there's a little bit of pushback on, how that money would be spent and where the checks and balances are for that.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Lisa Ramrica from KALW. And we're joined also by Ren Farrell from the Audio Academy class of 2021, one of Lisa's cohort. Hello, Ren.
Hey, Ben. How's it going?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And what are you following tonight?
I'm following Contra Costa County's Measure X. It's another sales tax measure. It's a 0.5% sales tax increase on general goods in Contra Costa County. It wouldn't apply to food and medicine, but it would apply to everything else. It's expected to generate $81 million a year for the next 20 years.
Right. So, Ren, this is a sales tax that would be about 10%. What are results looking like right now?
Right now, it looks like the measure is going to pass. It's got a 59% approval, 40% no. I spoke to the president of the Contra Costa County Taxpayers Association. She said that it's too soon to tell. She might be right about that. But from what I can see, it looks like Contra Costa County wants this measure to go through.
Right. So the Taxpayers Association is opposing it. But the you've said that there's a coalition, this is in your election brief, a coalition of local business owners and community groups supports the measure. And is it especially important now in a pandemic?
Yeah, that's, people go back and forth. Some people say that it's a terrible time to raise taxes. Some people say that it's now more than ever, we need money to be going into the county's infrastructure. Just depends on who you ask.
Yeah, it's tough with a lot of these sales tax measures because, there is money needed for supporting hospitals, but it is hard to raise taxes right now. So we appreciate you looking into this further, Ren.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
That's Ren Farrell. He is a member of Audio Academy's class of 2021 here at KALW. Thanks very much. Also paying a lot of attention to, of course, the state measures that are happening. And we are at 60% now of precincts partially reporting here in California. And a couple of highlights here. One is that the bond to continue stem cell research, billions of dollars on the line, is about 50-50 right now. And so it's too early to tell on that. The affirmative action in government decisions that is Prop 16 right now is down 45% to 55%. To restore the right to vote after your prison term when you're on parole is ahead at 60%. And jumping up to Prop 22, app-based drivers and employee benefits, Prop 22 is winning with 58% of people saying yes at this point. You're listening to KALW special election coverage, The Bay Votes 2020. Follow our tweets at hashtag Bay Votes. We'll join you again in about 15 minutes. I'm Ben Trefney with Sonia Narang, and we are going back now to NPR's coverage of the national races.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2020 election. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Sarah McCammon. We are waiting for several crucial swing states to be called in the 2020 presidential election. Former Vice President Joe Biden struck a cautious tone when he addressed his supporters a little earlier.
We're going to have to be patient until the hard work of tallying the votes is finished. And it ain't over till every vote is counted, every ballot is counted.
Meanwhile, President Trump has tweeted with absolutely no evidence, quote, "We are up big, but they are trying to steal the election," end quote. To be clear, there has been no evidence of voter fraud or any attempt to steal this election.
President Trump has notched wins in states that were essential to his path to victory, like Florida, Ohio, Texas, and Iowa. But with races still too early to call in Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, a decisive call on the election could be days away. And I want to go now to two of our colleagues, Ron Elving and Juana Summers. Ron is a senior Washington editor and correspondent. And Ron, I want to start with you because we're hearing again President Trump falsely claiming without evidence that Democrats are trying to steal this election. We're hearing former Vice President Joe Biden say, let's wait, let's count every vote. Where do things stand right now?
Well, you have the law in the three states that we're mostly focused on at this point, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which says that they are not to start counting the absentee ballots, which are all completely legitimate, or at least as many of them as are completely legitimate. There may be a few that are not. But they can't even really start to assess that until Election Day. They can't do it early the way Arizona and some other states do. So as a result, without any new votes being cast after 8 o'clock tonight, they've got a mountain of ballots to make their way through, and it's going to take some hours. And they are not going to be done by machines. They're not going to be done by some sort of cyborg. They're going to have to be done by human beings. And those people are going to work long and hard through many hours to get it done. Now, Wisconsin may very well get it done first. Milwaukee was saying earlier tonight that they thought they could do it by dawn, by, say, 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. That's just Milwaukee County, but that would give us an indication of how big a bulge Biden's going to get out of that biggest population county in that one state. Then we move on to Michigan, we move on to Pennsylvania, probably in that order, and it will probably be until Friday before we're really certain who got the nod in Pennsylvania. Now, there's a theory, there's a theoretical way that Biden could win without Pennsylvania, but much, much easier for him to win if he gets Pennsylvania, and that may take until Friday.
And as we heard from our guest a moment ago, the process, as you say, Ron, of counting these ballots, it's very labor-intensive. There are envelopes to open. There are boxes to check. There are lots of verifications to get through. And when you have thousands upon thousands of mail-in ballots, early ballots, in a lot of these places, that it just takes a while. And Juana Summers, I want to go to you. She's an NPR political reporter covering demographics. You have been reporting on again, on demographics, and it's possible that some of these cities that have a very large African-American electorate, places like Detroit, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, could be really key in this election, right?
They absolutely could. And the thing that I keep coming back to when I think about these states that are outstanding are these large metropolitan areas, and even, frankly, some of the rural areas that have a large share of Black voters. As we know, during the Democratic presidential primary, these are the voters that effectively saved Joe Biden's campaign's hopes. They carried him decisively, starting with that victory in South Carolina, all across the South, strong showings in those Midwestern states. So I'm watching to see what those voters do there. These are also areas, I should point out, that the campaign in the closing days of this race deployed California Senator Kamala Harris, who is a daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, to these states. They have been working aggressively to boost Black turnout there at higher levels than 2016. They're hoping to get somewhere around the range of what we saw perhaps in 2012.
Yeah, and what states do you see the African-American vote as being most important?
I am really, really watching what's happening in Georgia right now. That's one of those states where we're not going to have a lot of answers tonight. That, you know, that's not satisfying for a lot of folks. But I'm looking to see what Black voters in particular will do in the Atlanta area there. Is what I think they're going to be one of the big keys.
Again, another place where the vote count has been held up a bit, right? Because of, I think, a pipe that burst in the Atlanta area.
Yeah, that's right. We're still going to be waiting there for some time. And that's why the word of the night again is patience.
Patience. And Juana, this has also been a year, of course, marked by the national reckoning over race and justice. How have those issues played with these voters that you're looking closely at?
Yeah, I mean, we spent a lot of the summer in a season of protests after the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota. And generally speaking, we know that many voters say that racism is a big problem in this country. But we are seeing from some survey data that when you ask voters what issues are most important to them, the main concern they're still talking about is the coronavirus pandemic, which has obviously killed more than 230,000 Americans. Race coming a little bit further down on the list, race and policing issues specifically, are not resonating as the top issue. While voters do still say these are important issues to our society.
Of course, worth pointing out, though, that even the coronavirus pandemic has a substantial intersection with race, right? Because of the disproportionate impact it's had on people of color. Is that something that you've heard from these voters or from Democrats trying to get out the vote?
Absolutely. I think the message that we've heard from Democrats in particular is that people's lives are literally at stake in this election. That is messaging they've been using with their messaging to Black voters, to Latino voters, pointing out that it's a life or death issue now, and tying the fact that they believe that the president has mishandled this pandemic and is to blame for these deaths is very much a part of their messaging.
Yeah, talk to us more about how, you know, what has each candidate's message been to African-American voters? Maybe start with Biden.
Sure. We'll start with the Biden campaign. You know, they have pointed out exactly what you're saying, Sarah, that the coronavirus pandemic has been deadly for Black voters, that the economic recovery has been slower for them, that black Americans have been left behind by this president. And they have said that Democrats will be a champion for them. And on the other side of the spectrum, you have the Trump campaign, which has, you know, essentially tried to tie every single negative thing that has ever happened to Joe Biden. They've attacked him for the crime bill in the 90s. They have suggested that Joe Biden would be bad for the country. They've had a specific focus, as our colleague Aisha Roscoe has reported, on Black men, maybe not even so much trying to get them to vote for the president's reelection campaign. And they won't say this publicly, but a lot of their strategy seems to be to depress turnout, to get Black men not to show up at all. And we know that Black men voted for the president at higher rates than their black women counterparts. And we know that Black men also vote at a lower rate than Black women, who are pretty reliable Democratic voters.
Right. You see that gender gap among African-American voters as well as among white voters to some extent. That's NPR's Juana Summers, political reporter covering demographics. We've also been talking with Ron Elving, senior Washington editor correspondent. Thanks to you both. I want to go now to a pollster, Celinda Lake. She's a political strategist for the Democratic Party, who's also done some polling for the Biden campaign. Although, Celinda, I understand you do not speak for the campaign. Is that right?
Right. That's right.
And also president of Lake Research Partners. We are waiting on President Trump to speak, so we may have just a couple of minutes here. But while we're waiting, I want to ask you, just bring us up to speed on how former Vice President Biden's polling has looked, up to this point.
Well, it's looked good, and, you know, we've had a lead nationally. It's been much closer in battleground states, and frankly, it's pretty much played out the way that we thought it would. We had multiple routes to victory, and one is through the Midwest, and one is including some new states like Arizona. And the campaigns had two very different philosophies. Donald Trump encouraged his voters to vote on Election Day. We encouraged our voters to vote early and by mail. And so the way disproportionate number of votes that are out there still to be counted are our votes.
And based on what you're seeing so far, though, granted that, as you say, there are still a lot of votes to be counted, how does what you're seeing match the polling that you've seen up to this point?
Well, the states don't have a lot of the urban vote in. So, you know, all of the public and private polling showed a small 4 to 5 point lead in Pennsylvania, 3 to 6, 7 point lead in Wisconsin, and, a very close race in Georgia, a couple point lead in Arizona. And frankly, the lead has been greater than the polling had shown. So winning Michigan. So the polling, the current results don't reflect the polling, not because the polling was off, but because the ballots haven't been counted.
And you're confident that as those ballots come in and are counted, things will begin to match up more closely.
I think that's right. And in fact, they did in the states that have already been counted.
As you look at the map, are there places that are concerning you in particular?
Well, it's these races are tight, and I came to the table knowing that these were going to be tight races and that both sides had strong bases. That doesn't concern me. What concerns me and what is very, very important here is that the voters get to speak tonight. They get to pick the president, and every vote should be counted equally. Those and the attempts not to count ballots, that's what concerns me, not the patterns of the ballots that were cast.
What do you make of former Vice President Joe Biden's disappointing results in Florida? Of course, President Trump has won that state. It appears that former Vice President Biden underperformed among Latino voters there. Is that something that should concern Democrats?
Well, the Latino vote is very, very diverse. And particularly in Florida, you have the Puerto Rican vote, you have the Central American vote, you have the Cuban American vote. And then in other states, you have in Texas, the Tejano vote, the Mexican American vote. In Arizona, you have the Mexican American vote. So we underperformed in Miami-Dade. We overperformed in Arizona. And I think it's just it's time to appreciate the diversity of the community and the different approaches and different messages that work with and different interests that different groups have. We should not be treating the Latino vote as monolithic. It's not.
What do you think that will mean in terms of how Democrats might retool their message going forward?
I think that we need to give more emphasis to Latino men because there's also quite a gender gap in the Latino community. And I think that we need particularly to treat seriously, which we did in the campaign, but late, the socialist attack in the Central American community. And I think that we need to address the concerns of Puerto Ricans, many of whom feel Puerto Rico has been left behind by both parties.
That is Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners and a pollster and political strategist for the Democratic Party. Thanks, as always, Celinda, for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. I want to bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith now. Hey, Tam.
Hello.
All right. So long night. There's going to be days ahead that we will still be watching for results. Can you just catch us up on the map so far for President Trump and Joe Biden and obviously the important battleground states that we have left to wonder about?
Yeah, so the map has a lot of gray on it in the areas where we most want answers, in short. So President Trump has won the states that you would expect a Republican to win. Former Vice President Joe Biden has won the states that you would expect a Democrat to win. And then there are the rest of them. And we are waiting for calls in Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Maine, part of Nebraska, the congressional districts in Nebraska that have electoral votes that come with them. What we do know, though, is that President Trump has won Florida and Texas and Ohio and Iowa. These are some states that at some point had been thought to be potentially in reach for Joe Biden, and President Trump has won those states based on the AP calls.
Right. And tell us about, you know, we were watching the Sun Belt states so closely,
yeah.
Florida, Georgia, Texas, Arizona. I guess where does the path pan out now that we know how a lot of those Sun Belt states have panned out?
Well, except for the part where we aren't totally sure about Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, right. Which are three very important Sun Belt states that we've been watching. What we do know is that President Trump has won Florida and Texas, and those are big ones with a lot of electoral votes that come with them. Arizona looks to be trending toward Biden, but it's not clear yet. And in some ways, what we know now is that those three states, those three so-called blue wall states from 2016 that President Trump won.
Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we could get them tattooed on our somewheres. those states are going to matter, and those states are not going to have conclusive results tonight.
Exactly. All right. Well, hold that thought. That is NPR's Tamara Keith. You are listening to live special coverage of the 2020 election from NPR News.
Bringing back a little Pointer Sisters. This is the Bay Votes 2020 special election covered from KALW Public Media. Yes, this is a long night that may stretch into early morning and later in the week. We've been hearing that we might not hear returns finalized in Pennsylvania until Friday, but KALW will keep you informed the whole time. I'm Ben Trefney, news director here at the station, joined by Sonia Narang, elections coverage manager for KALW News. Hello, Sonia.
Hi, Ben.
How are you doing at 10:35?
It's going well. How are you doing over there in the station?
I'm doing very well also. It is good to be here with our team of people who are helping out. We have heard from dozens of people tonight here at KALW and really appreciate the work that Your Call and City Visions did as well, as well as, of course, the whole NPR team bringing you this news that is breaking and stressful and unpredictable from all around the country. But we're going to focus in on the Bay Area right now and for the next 25 minutes or so, and we're going to go to Solano County and Fairfield, where we have Azul Dahlstrom Ekman, one of our Audio Academy class of 2021, who's been following one of the ballot measures there. Azul, how are you?
Hi, Ben. I'm doing well. How
good.
Are you?
I'm doing all right. So can you tell me what you've been following there and what it's about?
Yeah, so I've been following Measure C in Fairfield. And so what Measure C proposes to do is to create a tax on businesses that sell cannabis in Fairfield. So it affects retail operations like dispensaries, places that grow cannabis, and places that turn cannabis into other items like food or rope. So if it doesn't pass, no additional tax will apply in Fairfield, but the California state tax on cannabis will still be in effect.
That's right. So Fairfield could be cashing in a little bit here. If they pass it, what are the results right now, Azul?
So 69% of the vote is in favor of Measure C, and it should be noted that there's also a similar cannabis tax measure happening in Vacaville, which is neighboring Fairfield and also in Solano County, which appears to be passing as well with a similar percentage of votes.
All right, and there are some more around the region as well. We'll get to those in a minute, but thank you very much for your time, Azul.
Thanks, Ben.
That's Azul Dahlstrom Ekman from KALW. And as I noted, there's another cannabis business tax in the city of Sonoma. That is Measure X. And that is passing with 80% of the vote as yes so far. And that's with 80% of the precincts reporting. So that one looks like it's going to pass in Sonoma. And I think we have more about Sonoma, Sonia.
Yeah, we have Annalise Finney with us. She is an Audio Academy Fellow talking about Sonoma Measure P. Hi, Annalise.
Hey, Sonia. How are you?
I'm good. So you've been looking into this measure that would expand oversight of Sonoma County's Sheriff's Department. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Sonoma Measure P is one of six local measures that are on the ballot this year in the Bay that would strengthen civilian oversight of law enforcement. In Sonoma in particular, that law enforcement is the sheriff. And if Measure P passes, the oversight office that oversees the sheriff would have more powers, like the ability to directly subpoena records and to contact witnesses.
Yeah, and I know we talked about this measure at length earlier a few weeks ago, and you said the sheriff doesn't like this measure. Why is that?
Yes, Sheriff Mark Essick has been a strong opponent of this bill, and he says that he sees some potential legal challenges either from his office or someone else because he thinks this bill would impinge on the sheriff's independence. Sheriffs are elected independently and don't have the same oversight by cities as police do. But some supporters say that the way this bill is written actually doesn't impinge on his independence. So there's a little bit of a back and forth there.
Yeah. Can you tell me, I know you've spoken to some supporters. What are they saying?
Yeah, I recently spoke with Kimmy Barbosa, who worked on the Yes campaign for the North Bay Organizing Project, and she was pretty excited. The results are definitely in the favor of the Yes campaign. Currently, it's 60% supporting the yes and 32.9% supporting the no vote. She says that these results are a resounding affirmation that Sonoma County wants oversight and they want justice when members of the community are hurt by sheriff's deputies.
Okay, so it looks like it's overwhelmingly yes at this point in the night.
Yes, it certainly does.
Thanks very much, Annalise. Annalise Finney from KALW's Audio Academy Class of 2021. Appreciate that information about Sonoma County. And I'm going to turn to the state now. And we had a dozen ballot measures that were at the state level with just over 60% of the vote right now. We have five that are passing. That includes the bonds to continue stem cell research, which is very, very close, but it's passing with 51% of the vote at this moment. And we still have about 39% of the precincts to count around the state. Also, the Prop 17 to restore the right to vote after prison terms is passing with about 60% of the vote. So that would allow parolees the right to vote. Prop 19, which would change certain property tax rules, particularly for people who are 55 years old and older, and also people who are inheriting properties, that is passing with 52% of the vote. Again, this is very close at this point in the evening, so we'll have to monitor this and see what happens as the hours go on. And then Prop 24, which would amend consumer privacy laws, that is passing with 56% of the vote. And we're joined now by KALW's Teresa Katsourilos, and you are monitoring Prop 22. Is that right, Teresa?
That's right. That's right. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, right now, I see that that has 58% of the vote with we're looking at about 3/5 of the vote cast, counted. Mm-hmm. So 58% is voting yes on Prop 22, Teresa. What do you have to say about that?
I would say that it is not surprising, though it is something of a blow to organized labor in the state, depending on how you view that.
What is it going to mean for organized labor that it doesn't pass?
Yeah, that's a good question. So just to give a little backstory, what Prop 22 does, it determines whether companies like Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash have to actually follow state labor laws. Earlier this year, California passed a law that defined implemented a law that defined who's considered an independent contractor and who's considered an employee. Right. Under that new law, gig companies have to extend benefits to employees like drivers. Prop 22 overrides that law and basically says that they don't have to. So if Prop 22 passes, the benefits that these drivers and other gig workers will get will be quite limited.
Right. So you're referring to AB 5 there. Oh. Teresa, can you tell us what some of the...
Sorry about that. That was a source.
Oh, well, do you want to share?
Good heavens.
If that is a supporter of, you know, they had a lot of big funding behind this measure. You know, Uber, DoorDash, Lyft put a lot of money behind it. Are you hearing what they're saying right now?
I have yet to check in with those particular sources. I must say, I assume that they are quite pleased with this result. They did spend over $200 million pushing this through.
Yeah, that is a lot of money. And so it looks like operations will continue to stay the same as they have been.
Yeah, what have you, I'm wondering, what has this said to you as you've been watching the evolution of Prop 22, Teresa, from the labor perspective and the way in which corporations and labor have been squaring off in the buildup to Prop 22, which is really, I think, probably the most high-profile proposition that's on the California ballot. Teresa, have you been seeing the fact that there's been so much money put into this race? Is that... said anything to you about the way in which, you know, this representative democracy has worked? I think that Teresa, as I could see on Zoom, is actually talking with that source right now. But I could tell you, Sonia, that having $200 million over against what organized labor has put in, I think somewhere between 10 and 20 million, 10 times difference is pretty significant.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, when you look at these props, you have to look at where the money's coming from and how much is being spent on a lot of these props. And, you know, Prop 22 was one that had a huge amount of funding, as we mentioned earlier. You know, I also want to talk about Prop 16, which had also a larger amount of yes funding. You know, that's a prop I want to talk about with Brittany who is here with us. Now, this is Brittany Chiquata, who is the Chief of Staff at the San Francisco Commission of Human Rights. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Sonia. How's it going?
It's going well. It's really nice to have you with us. You know, we're talking about California props, and you work at the intersection of racial and gender justice in your mm-hmm. role at the Human Rights Commission. And, you know, taking a look at Prop 16, which deals with affirmative action, can you tell us what kind of change that could bring about?
I mean, Prop 16 would be really consequential for both women across the state and people of color, centering Black people and Latinx people in opportunities for government contracts, admissions to public education, and really just, I think, across the life course, especially when we're considering, you know, the percentage of single parent households that are led by women in the state, the ways in which women as caretakers have been impacted by the pandemic. And really, when we talk about economic security, we're talking about racial justice, and Prop 16 is really an opportunity to extend both to women who are underperforming in California as compared to other states when it comes to entrepreneurship and really having access to those government 600,000 government contracts right. that go out annually.
Right. Well, we're make a big change, but it's not passing at this moment.
Yeah,
it looks like we
just got an update. We have almost 2/3 of the precincts partially reporting in California right now, and at the moment, Prop 16 is down 55% to 45%. So it's not a done deal yet, but it is lagging.
It is, unfortunately. And, you know, I am generally a very positive person, so I'm not ready to do a postmortem yet. But I think that, you know, one challenge that I witnessed just as a spectator is that a lot of emphasis was put pretty singularly on the Black vote in California. And while we are the margin to victory, we're not the only voters. And I think this was one of those ballot measures where you really had to reach across identities and emphasize the ways in which women across racial demographics were gonna benefit from this proposition. You know, white women, even before this initiative got to the ballot, were historically beneficiaries of affirmative action in just about every case study that exists. But we still have a little bit of time. I see, I'm also following.
Yeah, the night is still young. The night is still young. Yeah. We're still going to follow.
The week is young, Sonia.
Yeah, the week is young. Yeah, exactly. I want to ask you also about Prop 17. Prop 17 restores the right to vote for parolees. Now, that looks, as right now, that it's at 60% with yes votes. Can you tell mm-hmm. us about your reaction to that from your vantage point?
Well, I think it's really beautiful that that's passing. And I also feel that if you look at strategies as far as just from each of the campaigns, that was, you know, there was a different strategy there. It wasn't as singularly racialized because parolees span across identities. And I think that that might contribute to why you're seeing in some, you know, redder leaning counties that this is passing as well versus Prop 16. But I think it's really beautiful and exciting opportunity that we will be extending this human right to people who should not be disenfranchised just because of mm-hmm. What they may or may not have done. Because I'm one of those people who doesn't even believe that everyone who's incarcerated is guilty of the crime that they are incarcerated for. So I'm excited about this opportunity.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you about one last prop. I was actually reading your Move in Unity Victory in Action Ballot Guide, the MUVA Voter Guide, which you co-authored.
MUVA.
Yes, MUFA, with Shakira Simley at the San Francisco Office of Racial Equity. And I want to ask you about Prop 25. As you know, right now it looks that it's going to be, you know, favoring the no vote, you know, mm-hmm. and you did endorse it as no. You said that this is not the right solution. Why is it not the right solution?
Yeah, I got a lot of texts and question marks on that one in particular. And I think if you compare different ballot guides, you saw a lot of no endorsements on that one because it is really tricky. And at the end of the day, I landed on a no because, you know, without question, our current justice system is flawed. It is racist. It is predatory in nature. But I am a person who subscribes to the belief that algorithms are just opinions in code. And I was not convinced that a former Enron executive who was funding this campaign from the Arnold Foundation was the best person whose hands this should lie in as far as how we design a tech algorithm to decide who goes to jail and who doesn't.
Right. And just to remind people, this is a prop that would eliminate the money bail system and replace it with a risk assessment. Thank you so much, Brittany, for being with us today. And
yes,
Brittany Chiquata is the chief of staff at the San Francisco Human Rights Commission.
And we're going to go to Richmond now, to Lisbeth Ibarra, who's a 16-year-old with the Rise Youth Center there. Lisbeth, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well, thanks for staying up late. Of course, you're 16. Maybe you stay up later than I do usually anyway. But you phone banked 1,500 people in Richmond to get out the vote this year. How was that?
Yes, it's been a lot. It's just been a lot of calling. I think now I've gotten almost like 2,000 people that I've phone banked. Mm. And just like all of Rise, it's just been a lot of people. You know, a lot of like people not answering for some reason. They don't want to talk to us.
Sure.
But there's also been times where we come across like people who really didn't know or hadn't heard about Measure U or Proposition 15. And it's really nice when we actually get informed them about something they've never heard of. And they're like, yeah, like I'm going to vote for this and I'm going to do this for my community because it benefits us.
Yeah,
so I think
amazing.
It's definitely, yeah, it's been a learning experience.
What did you learn while you did this?
I learned that like, people aren't as involved as I thought they are, like, especially in my community. I thought that, since we're in the Bay Area, I thought, like, you know, like, we're so progressive or whatever, but I didn't realize there were so many Republicans in Richmond, and I didn't realize that there was a lot of people who, like, just didn't want to talk about it or didn't want to share, like, what they were going to vote for. But I also learned that it's important to share this information and share what we know with everyone, because you are going to come across people who really value this information and people who had never heard of, you know, specific measures or propositions.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, Elizabeth. So you're 16 years old. Are many of your peers as engaged in this election and in the voting process and democracy as you are, would you say?
Yeah, I would say, I think that a lot of the people that I personally know are very involved, because I know a lot of people from the Rise Youth Center or another organization that I'm a part of, Youth Versus Apocalypse, which are like just a lot of young people, Rise and Youth Versus Apocalypse. So I think since I'm surrounded by so many people like that, we've definitely been very involved. But also because it's been so accessible, all this information, through social media and through, especially like I feel like I've gotten a lot of information from TikTok and Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of like really valuable information that I feel like a couple years back we never would have got, especially young people, seeing so many young people showing up to the polls.
Yeah. And I wonder, Elizabeth, were you excited about seeing a youth voting measure as a California state prop? And what do you think about the fact that it is on favoring the no side?
Yeah, I was definitely excited, especially because I knew that like I have a lot of friends who like the next election they're not going to be 18, or I have a lot of friends that even during this election like they turn 18 like in a couple weeks, so it really mm-hmm. sucks that they don't get a vote. And especially because this election, or really all the elections, are going to impact us, because it's really our futures at the hands of like these quote unquote leaders. So I was really excited to see that there was like a proposition leaning towards that. But also I think just seeing that there's a lot of people who are voting no on it makes me really concerned, because it makes me question like, why don't people want younger people to vote, or why don't people want younger people to have that like right to vote? And also I think maybe a part of that is because there's still a lot of older people and older Republicans who are seeing that like young people have so much power and are using their voices, and I think they're getting scared.
Hmm. Yeah, and you're an example of a young person who is using your voice, and you are going out there and making a difference in this election by being so civically engaged. And we're really happy to have you on our airwaves, Lizbeth, and thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Lizbeth. That was Lizbeth Ibarra, a 16-year-old from the Rise Youth Center in Richmond.
And if Lizbeth lived in Oakland, then Measure QQ, which is passing there, would allow her to vote for school board director because it has about 2/3 of the vote. So just that's a little bit of good news for some of your contemporaries there, Lizbeth. We'll go to Ashley McBride, who is an education reporter with the Oakland side. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us and staying up late.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So you've been focused on education equity, which has been so important in the middle of this pandemic. It's been a big issue here in San Francisco. How are the candidates slated to win the Oakland Unified School District Board going to reshape the school system moving forward, would you say?
I would say based on the results that we have so far, it looks like a lot of the leading candidates are teachers or former teachers, which is kind of a new thing on the OUSD board. I think there are only one or two current board members who came from the classroom or came from a school. And several of the leading candidates, Sam Davis in District 1, Van Cedric Williams in District 3, and Clifford Thompson in District 7 are all former teachers or principals. And Mike Hutchinson, who's leading in District 5, also used to work in schools and is an education activist.
And Ashley, another issue you've been following is Oakland's Measure Y. Now, this is a measure that could bring in $735 million into Oakland schools. So can you tell us a little bit about how this measure is doing tonight and what exactly this money would be spent on?
Sure. So it looks to be headed towards approval. It has about 77% of the yes vote, and it needs 55% to win. And so if it is passed by the voters, several schools across OUSD that have already been identified will get infrastructure upgrades that can go to things like extra classrooms or becoming more energy efficient or all kinds of things. There's been a number of improvements that the board is looking for that would improve education during the time of COVID. So, for example, making ventilation better in some of the school buildings, those kinds of things.
I'm wondering, Ashley, because we talked about how the measure to allow 17-year-olds to vote in primaries in the state is failing right now, but I mentioned that Oakland Measure QQ, which would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in a school board election, is passing. What do you attribute the difference for voters in Oakland compared with those around the rest of the state on these youth voting issues?
I will say that I haven't been following the state proposition too closely, but from what I've seen around Measure QQ in Oakland, it seemed to have overwhelming support from most people. The students who were involved with getting it on the ballot are all very passionate and are very good at convincing people to vote for Measure QQ. There weren't really very many arguments against it, so I'm not surprised that it's leading right now.
Well, thanks so much, Ashley, for sharing your thoughts on all the education issues you've been covering for a while in Oakland.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Ashley McBride. She is an education reporter with Oakland Side.
And I wanted to note also that in San Francisco, there is another measure that would allow 17-year-olds and 16-year-olds, I think, too, Sonia, to vote in local elections, municipal elections, and that is barely winning right now. It has just over 50% yes vote. That's all mail-in ballots and 80% of other precincts reporting. So it's a pretty razor-thin margin right now, but that is passing. We're coming up upon the end of the hour. We're going to go back to NPR's national coverage at 11 p.m., but I want to give a quick recap of some of the highlights in the state ballot measures. We have nearly 2/3 counted so far, and the ones about stem cell research and parolees voting and changing property tax rules and app-based drivers being able to stay contractors and also amending consumer privacy laws, those are all passing. That is measures 14, 17, 19, 22 and 24. You could find more information about that at electionresults.sos.ca.gov. And we'll have much more information about that tomorrow on Cross Currents and the Cross Currents Morning Report as we continue this coverage from KALW. Sonia, I was wondering if you have any final thoughts on the evening as we wrap up our local coverage.
Well, it has been a long evening, and I want to thank all the listeners that have stayed with us through the night to hear what's going on. And, you know, it's been enlightening to hear from the Audio Academy fellows that have been covering these measures for weeks. So thank you for listening to all of you.
And I want to also thank our team here behind the scenes, Shereen Adel, Angela Johnston, Chris Agusa, Debbie Kennedy, Tina Pamantuan, John Carroll, and so many more people who have helped us bring you this election coverage. KALW is listener-supported public radio. We are supported by you, and we are KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. Back to NPR. Have a nice evening.